Hello, everybody. I am glad to be here, and the commission is glad to be here in Houston, Texas. And I want to thank particularly the Houston Zoo and all the staff and Texas Parks and Wildlife staff, because I know this has been an added burden. But I just think it's a wonderful opportunity for us as the commission to come out to where our constituents are. You know, I laughingly say we don't all live in Austin. And Houston, obviously, is a great place and been a great and a wonderful municipality and a group of people that have supported our mission for many, many years. So we're very, very glad to be in Houston, Harris County, and the surrounding area. We're going to have our normal meeting this morning and going through the various committees, and then this afternoon is our public meeting starting at 2 o'clock. And so it'll be a long and busy day, but certainly very glad to be here in Houston and Vice Chairman Freakin's backyard. So thank you, Dan. We appreciate that very much. So with that, we'll get started. This meeting is called to order. Before proceeding with any business, I believe Mr. Smith has a statement to make.
I do. Thank you, Chairman. A public notice of this meeting containing all items on the proposed agenda has been filed in the office of the Secretary of State as required by Chapter 551 Government Code, referred to as the Open Meetings Act. I would like for this fact to be noted in the official minutes of the record.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. We'll begin right away with Regulations Committee. Commissioner Freakin, please call your committee to order.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay, first order of business is approval of the previous committee meeting minutes, which have already been distributed. Motion for approval?
Moved.
Moved by Commissioner Brown.
Second.
Second by Commissioner Dixon. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, motion carries. Committee item number one, land and water plan update. Mr. Smith.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate it. Couple things I want to talk about. Obviously, September 1st is a big day for us. Opening day of dove season for much of the state. A key part of our land and water plan is to help promote more outdoor recreational opportunities, particularly hunting. As I think y'all are aware, there was a proposal to modify the dove season in the South Zone to take the last week of the first split and move it to the end of the second split. We went out to get extensive comment on that, and Vernon Bevel is going to talk more about that later on in the day. We opted not to make any changes, but suffice to say, we heard a lot from hunters during the course of that public outreach about issues and ideas they had with respect to the timing of the opening, bag limits, the effect of fuel prices on their hunting patterns. And so we think it's probably appropriate to go out with some more extensive attitudinal surveys of our dove hunters around the state. And so we're going to work with Texas State probably starting in January to really look at some comprehensive attitudes and get some feedback. And so we're excited about that process coming up. The second matter that I want to bring up, I think all of you are aware, is that we have had some healthy differences of opinion with the National Marine Fisheries Service on kind of the best way to help recover our red snapper stocks. And I think we're all very much in concurrence that we want to get that species of reef fish recovered. We want it to help support a very viable commercial and recreational industry. We just had some differences of opinion about the best way to make that happen. When the agency made the decision back in January not to comport with the federal catch guidelines for recreational fishing on red snapper, the National Marine Fisheries imposed a fairly draconian restriction on recreational fisheries inside federal waters. So we have expressed, our concern about that, our desire to work with them. We just learned at the Gulf of Mexico Fisheries Council last week that the council has approved a recommendation to take to the Secretary of Commerce that would cause all federally permitted charter and headboats to comply with federal restrictions with respect to red snapper while fishing in state waters. So that will mean that that element of the recreational fishery is going to have to comply with stricter federal standards. And so that is, again, a source of some consternation to us. Again, we share a goal of wanting to recover this species. We think it's in good shape. It's improving. but we have some differences about how best to handle that. So that may be something that we're going to want to talk more with the commission about in the future.
Thank you. Okay. Thanks, Carter. Committee item number two, request permission to review rules. Yes, anybody?
Good morning, Commissioners. For the record, I'm Ann Bright, General Counsel. Once every 4 years, the department is statutorily required to go through a rule review process. We review all of our rules. The review has to include an assessment of whether we still need the rules. We have to publish notice of the review in the Texas Register. And then after we've completed the review, we come back to the commission and request that they either be readopted, adopted with changes, or repealed based on the review. This is usually a three-meeting process. If you'll recall, back in May, we talked about sort of the first round of these. Usually the first meeting, we seek permission to review the rules. The second meeting, after we've completed the review, we ask the commission for permission to make changes to these rules. In the third meeting, we adopt the changes, and we request that the commission adopt the completed review, basically sort of deeming it to be complete. This is a schedule, and I realize this is kind of a busy slide, but this kind of shows you the schedule. We do it by chapter. The three chapters that we're looking to start reviewing right now are Chapters 53, Finance, Chapter 59, Parks, and Chapter 69, Resource Protection. So the staff is now here today to request permission to begin the review process for these three chapters. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions or discussion? No further questions or discussion. I'll authorize staff to begin the rule review. Thanks, Ann. And committee item number three, rule review, request permission to publish the page changes. I'm right.
All right. Good morning again. For the record, I'm still Ann Bright, General Counsel. As I mentioned, in May, we came and we asked the commission for permission to begin the rule review process for a few of our chapters, Chapter 51, Executive, 52, Wildlife and Fisheries, 55, Law Enforcement, and 61, Design and Construction. We've completed that review, and now we're here to request permission to propose changes. On Chapter 51, that contains the provisions for petitions for rulemaking. As you know, a member of the public is authorized under the Administrative Procedure Act to request that the commission adopt a rule or make a rule change. We've got a rule in Parks and Wildlife rules that address the process for that. One of the things that there have been actually a couple of things that have come up in recent years that we're recommending we change. One is occasionally we will receive a petition for rulemaking that is almost identical to a petition that the commission has already decided, or at least not decided, to take action on. And what we are requesting is that staff be authorized to go ahead and reject a petition for rulemaking if it's identical to one that was received within the last 6 months, that are rejected within the last 6 months. The other situation, a lot of times the public, often they have some very, very good ideas that they give to us, and staff wants to pursue rulemaking and bring that to the commission. We would like to alter the process so that it's clear that if there is a petition and staff is recommending that the agency proceed with rulemaking, staff will go ahead and work with the executive director to put it on the agenda for the next commission meeting. We also would like to revise Subchapter C on fundraising. I think when Mary does her financial presentation today and tomorrow, she's going to talk a little bit about changing the handling of donations and the investment policy, and we just want to make sure that we're consistent. It basically has to do with being able to use donated funds more quickly. And then the Hunter Education Rules, the passing grade, there's a little... basically just an error that we need to correct having to do with live courses versus online courses. There's a Chapter 52, which is the stalking policy, and we just want to change the name of that to be more accurate. We aren't requesting any changes to law enforcement chapter. Chapter 61 has to do with design and construction, and this really has to do with the regional park grant program. Back in January, the commission made a number of changes to the rules regarding regional parks or state park grants. Regional parks were not included in that for several reasons, and we would like to go back and make conforming changes to that section or that chapter. So now staff is requesting permission to publish changes in the Texas Register for comment for 51, 52, 55, and 61. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions, Grant? Thanks, Ann. No further questions or discussion. I'll authorize staff to publish this item in the Texas Register for the required public comment period. Item number four, Southern Flounder update.
For the record, Chairman and Commissioners, my name is Robin Rikers of the Coastal Fisheries Division. I'm here to present you a brief overview of the southern flounder stocks in Texas and a description of the fishery here in Texas. To begin with, and I'm going to start with the flounder that's right under the title, Flounder Life Cycle, and I know you may not be able to read this, but basically adults, which are anywhere from 1.75 to 2 years old, start to migrate offshore in October to December. Basically, they're seeking water that's 50 to 100 feet where they'll lay their eggs. They lay a buoyant pelagic egg that's fertilized by the males. It'll basically move back and drift back into the bays with the currents throughout the winter and spring period, and then the adults return gradually in the spring. The larvae basically move to the back bays, our nursery areas. They settle down there while your juveniles from the previous year will start to move out into the open bay areas, and then the process starts all over again in the fall. Give you a little bit of that life history again. Of course, sexual maturity is reached at about 1.75 years. The males reach sexual maturity at an earlier length at 250 to 300 millimeters, which for you is about a 10 to 12 inch fish. Females reach that maturity at about 14 to 16 inches. The lifespan of the fishery or the flounder is about 6 years. And when I say these animals recruit to the fishery, what I mean is they reach the 14 inch minimum size limit for the recreational commercial fishery. They reach that for males at about 3 to 4 years and for females at about 1 to 2 years. I wanted to just give you a brief management chronology of this fishery because we have taken actions through time on this fishery. And the first one of note, in fact, is in 1981 when we had the ban on sale of red drum and spotted sea trout. And, of course, what that actually probably did was shift fishing pressure over to flounder as we removed red drum and spotted sea trout from the opportunity to catch that as a commercial species. Followed that up in 1988 with the trammel and gillnet ban, which basically took away effort in that fishery. We increased the recreational minimum size limit to 12 inches at that point and created a 20-fish bag limit. 1990, we had we put a 50% bycatch by-weight rule for shrimp boats, basically saying they could only have 50% in weight of bycatch as compared to shrimp on board the vessel. In 1996, we increased the minimum size limit again to 14 inches. We decreased the bag limits to 10 fish recreational with a 20 fish possession and a 60 fish commercial bag limit. And we also made that recreational limit apply aboard shrimping vessels. In 1999, one of the most significant recent actions that we took was limited entry program in the inshore finfish fishery. And, of course, much like the shrimp program and the crab limited entry program, it has a buyback element to it as well. In 2000, we had some significant shrimping rules that included a bycatch reduction device requirement, a bird requirement, as I referred to it here, and greater protection of our nursery areas, which would have been a significant action possibly for flounder as well. And then in 2006, because we felt like we were getting some abuse of that possession limit, we reduced the possession limit to equal the recreational bag limit of 10 fish. The next few slides that I'm going to show you is actually show you some of the current trends in the fishery, and I'm going to start with our fishery independent information. What you see there is both fall and spring gill nets, and you can see that through time since those actions first started taking, we basically have been in a downward catch per unit effort trend within our fishery independent information. And, of course, as we kind of indicated at the last meeting to you, we're seeing some low points in time, lowest point ever recorded in our spring gill nets of last year. When you look at the bag seine catch rates, another fishery independent, one of our other sampling gears, you see less of a trend than you might see in that previous slide. And, of course, this basically is targeting those animals that are back up in that nursery area, younger animals. And it basically, we thought we were in a pretty steady recruitment phase, but then when you actually look at that 94-95 time period and you look to 2006, you can see a downward trend there. We have had a really good recruitment year in 2007, and we've seen some evidence of that in catches this year, we believe. That the recreational information, at least anecdotally, we're seeing some significant catches this year. Next, I'm going to turn to the fishery-dependent information. This basically is our recreational landings and our commercial landings, and I overlaid these together, and you can basically see that after the trammel nets were removed, those trends are fairly consistent with one another, and certainly as you get to that point from about 1999, we're showing a significant downward trend in both the recreational and commercial fisheries. I created this slide because oftentimes when we look at fishery independent and fishery dependent data, and in this case I did the fall gillnet catch rates and the private boat landings, sometimes that gets confusing because with that fishery dependent data, you'll actually get targeted effort at particular size species and so forth, and it can create some confusion or some confounding information. But in this case, you can actually see that both the fisheries independent and the fisheries dependent data track very well together, and they're showing very similar trends. Another measure of health in fisheries typically is the average or the mean length that we might see in our fisheries independent sampling gear. And here I show you the gillnet lengths. And you can see that basically since we started taking action in that 1981-82 time period, we have been increasing the overall mean length that we're seeing in our samples. And this actually is a very positive result of some of the actions we've taken. It's basically indicating that we are moving fish through those age classes, and we're getting some older fish out there, and so we have a better population structure than we had in that previous time frame as we've basically gotten fish to those older size classes. This next slide is a combination of all of our information as we feed it into a virtual population assessment model. This is a projection of what our spawning stock biomass is. Basically, it's taken the females that are greater than age 2, and what you will see is part of what is concerning us, which is since 1999, we're certainly see the projection of that spawning stock biomass or that reproductive potential going downwards. Next slide.
But if you go back to the previous slide before the biomass, maybe I didn't understand it. Isn't that indicating the fish are getting? You have more fish that are older fish?
This is the one confounding thing that, and I'm glad you picked up on that point. This is indicating we're getting older fish, and this would indicate that our overall biomass of older fish is, in fact, going down. And I'm going to provide some explanation for that a little bit later here when we get to, I'm going to discuss temperature in a little bit, and I think that will help explain this.
Okay.
The next few slides are just trying to indicate to you where this fishery is prosecuted, where the fishery takes place. And when you look at the recreational fishery, you see that Sabine, Galveston, and Matagorda make up for 85% of the recreational fishery, and then the rest of it spread out over the other few bay systems. When you look at the commercial landings, you'll notice the shift more to the mid-coast area, where San Antonio, Aransas, and Corpus Christi make up about 60% of the overall commercial landings, and then you got Galveston with about 10% and Lower Laguna Madre with about 15%. So as compared to the recreational fishery occurs on the upper coast, and the mid-coast basically has more of the commercial fishery. When you look at the percent of commercial landings by month, what you see is that 85% of all of our take, I'm sorry, about 60% of all the take occurs in October and November and December. And, of course, that coincides with that fall migration from the bays to the Gulf. When we've talked about this fishery in the past, we've always discussed the bycatch component in shrimp trawls. That component in our previous estimates made up about 80% of the fishing mortality in this fishery, with estimates of the overall individuals being caught ranging from about 1 million to 9 million in a particular year. The age group of that, they're basically age zeros and ones. They're in that 5 to 7 inch range. But what I can tell you is since 1994-92, when we had both peaks in brown shrimp effort and white shrimp effort, we've decreased that overall effort by greater than 90% for both of those species in the bays. Of course, in that time frame, we've also had the buyback program, the limited entry program, so that we've been able to take advantage of some of those decreases in effort. We've retired over 57% of the bay and bait licenses, and we've decreased the overall bycatch in the bays by at least 80%. So we believe why it's been a big component in the past, we do believe that's in check at this point in time. As we look to the actual commercial finfish licenses, of course, we put the limited entry program in 1999. You can see just a little bump up from 98, a little speculation probably going on as we put that license management program into place. We've been decreasing since that period of time. We bought back 29% of the licenses that we had available at that point in time, and that's a total of 161 licenses have been purchased, and we're just at a little over 400 licenses in this fishery. And I might add, in this fishery, it's both a flounder fishery and a black drum gillnet fishery, And only with the landings data can we parse out who's doing what, but they basically get a finfish license, and they can do either thing. Next, in kind of looking at this from a standpoint of what other impacts could be going on, what other habitat or environment influences could we be having in this fishery, recently for the summer flounder fishery, which is prosecuted on the Atlantic coast, they have seen some indication that higher winter temperatures were having an effect on their fishery. And we basically have followed that up, and their discussion suggests that it's either due to decreasing egg hatching or it's increased predation on larvae and early juveniles. And, of course, my next couple slides are going to help to explain what we've been able to find in that respect. When you look at our data in regards to temperature, the temperature is the green line. The bag seine catch rates is the yellow line here. And just to give you a frame of reference for those who don't calculate centigrade very well, 16 degrees centigrade is 61 degrees Fahrenheit. 18 degrees centigrade, which is about halfway up the scale on the temperature scale, is about 64 degrees centigrade. And as you can see, as we've moved through time, and especially since about 1993, we certainly have seen an increasing, a warmer water temperature in our bay systems. And if you mark that same kind of point in time, about 96 or so, you know, right after that 93 period, you can certainly see a decrease in the bag seines over that same period of time. To further illustrate that point, we basically took our fisheries independent data, our catch per unit effort of our bay trawls, and we lagged that against our January water temperatures. And you can see as temperature goes up, we've seen a significant decline in the overall bay trawl catches, which, of course, would be those young of the year, age 0, 1, 6-inch or so kind of fish. They would have moved out of larval stage and into the middle of the bay, basically. In summary, what that leads us to, and this presentation leads us to, as we discussed at the fishing forecast in the last meeting when I visited with y'all about that, was that we are seeing decreases in the overall southern flounder population. We do believe that part of those decreases are due to the high fishing pressure that we had in the past, as well as we believe those recent water temperatures may have further decreased the overall population. We believe that those temperatures have actually, in answer to your question, Commissioner Holt, they've actually probably shrunken the overall biomass that we can have right now. We probably don't have as much carrying capacity right now, given the current warmer water temperatures in the winter, as we had at one time. Now, if that trend changes, you know, we expect that we would see those bag seines to start going back up along with that temperature change, if that in fact occurs over the next few years, and some weather prognosticators indicate that that may in fact happen. Others don't necessarily buy into that theory. Basically, though, when you look at the mean length and the other things that we did, you know, it does indicate we've had some success with this fishery. We leveled off some of the real negative trends that we saw in the early 90s, but we've not reversed the overall trend. So with that in mind, obviously what we talked with you about was last time was we're going to be looking at our traditional measures such as bag limits, size limits, and probably some more non-traditional measures such as seasonal closures or reduced bag limits for certain periods and times of the year, especially during that fall run, that escapement period. And we're going to be working with a work group. We're going to create two work groups, actually, one a recreational and a commercial group. We're going to be calling those folks together in mid-September. We're going to kind of vet this information and other information through them. We would hope that that will prepare us for coastwide scoping meetings. We anticipate holding those meetings in Port Arthur, Dickinson, Port Lavaca, Rockport, and Port Isabel. We hope to do that in late September to early October. All of that pointing us at our November meeting so that we can narrow the window of options that we would bring to you in November. And then, obviously, we then go out for a further scoping process before we come back to you in January with our recommendation of what we would like to do. And we certainly hope by that point in time we have a lot of stakeholder buy-off on the proposal that we come to you with. With that, that concludes my presentation.
Question. Yeah. Sure. In this process, will you consider looking, you know, specifically at certain regions? Are we talking about a statewide rules, or are we talking about maybe by area or by the region?
Well, unlike where we did regionalization for spotted sea trout, really this trend is borne out up and down the coast. You know, we had a couple bay systems within the report I gave to you a couple weeks ago that actually showed a slight uptick for this year or last year for flounder, But overall, the trend's the same up and down the coast. So we really, I'm not anticipating that we will come to you with regional management because I don't really see this as a regional management issue at this point in time.
Okay.
Can you go back one, please?
What, again?
Back one more. No, it's not that. Anyway, I understand the correlation, obviously, with the higher temperatures, but are we certain that offtake through, recreational opportunity is a contributor?
Well, when you go back to the slide where we had recreational and commercial landings on there together, basically they're making up 50% of the catch in this fishery, and they were doing that prior. Now, before that, we had a considerable amount of bycatch mortality going on, and I think what we've done is basically traded bycatch mortality for this temperature effect that we're seeing, basically.
So we've definitively established a correlation between recreational and commercial offtake and the reduction. We know that it's a component of it. It's not other factors.
To
what extent? Is that right?
Well, we certainly know that fishing mortality is a component of it, and of course, while temperature may be having this effect, if we had been keeping up with the overall temperature effect, you would expect within our gears that our catch per unit effort would have stabilized itself. And, of course, we haven't seen that in our fishery independent information. So, we do believe there's certainly a fishing effect here, as well as there may be this reduced kind of carrying capacity effect. And that's probably not a bad term because that kind of alludes to habitat more than temperature. But it kind of has the same depressing effect on the stock.
Yeah, and Robin, getting back kind of what Commissioner Brown asked about, I was looking at your two charts. One, commercial landings seem to be farther south, Aransas, Corpus Christi, and San Antonio Bays, and the recreational is more north, Galveston Bay being the largest. But we're not measuring, when you come back to us, are we going to talk about those regional areas? Maybe help me. If we're not, why not?
Well, I think the problem, as we discussed, it is coast-wide, and certainly any savings we can get from any portions of the coast would be useful to this fishery. But certainly I understand what you're saying is that the commercial impacts, we might could regionally do something a little different for them in one location and do something a little different for the wrecks.
Right.
I would suspect that our committees will want to strongly look at that, or our working groups would want to strongly look at those kinds of options, and certainly we're open to whatever good, palatable options that we can create that will turn this fishery around. We're going to be looking at all those different options.
And I don't know where your baseline is, but have the fisheries dropped in pretty much the whole Texas coast, no matter more commercial, less commercial, more recreational?
Yes, no, we're seeing the same abundance trends, basically. Like I said, there's, from year to year, there's variation, but overall, the trend that we've seen is really coast-wide at this point in time.
Is that true of other states, then, also, if you visit with?
We have different fisheries independent. We're very lucky in that we have a very good fisheries independent program, so we can't model that in other states as well as we can. There's been some concern in Louisiana over there, southern flounder stocks as well. Like I said, I can't model it exactly the same way, but they have taken some recent actions in recent years.
So anecdotally, you're hearing that they're having some problems too.
Yes.
Okay. Yes.
Sure. How consistent is the water temperature throughout the coast?
It certainly, as you move to South Texas, is warmer in the South Texas region as compared to the upper coast. And that's one of the things that if we, we certainly recognize that fact. And in fact, I think when I may have put it in the fishing forecast with you the last meeting, last year in our bag seines in Lower Laguna Madre, I believe we didn't have any catch of flounder in that location last year. Now, we never caught a whole lot down there, so it's not totally abnormal that you wouldn't have any. But that certainly is part of the cause for concern. But certainly as you move up the coast, the water becomes cooler. And so that may be what has actually happened, is it may have pulled its range back up into that Galveston-Sabine range where you're going to have those cooler water temperatures.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Robin, we've been monitoring water temperatures on the coast for about 30 years, haven't we, throughout the entire coast?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Just want folks to know we're paying attention to that pretty close, yes.
And recreationally, it's still gig.
Yes. In the recreational fisheries, both a hook and line as well as a gig fishery, yes.
Okay. Well, we're looking forward to working with Commissioner Bailey.
You've got a chart on page 6 of the book that's spawning stock biomass of female flounder. and it ends in 05. Do you have any idea of where the line would be today?
Well, given what our fisheries independent information has done, and I apologize, that was the last assessment that we did there as far as the VPA goes. But given what we've currently seen in our fisheries independent information and a further decline of that, that would have probably gone on downward in a further decline. And, of course, that's why we're here before you. So,
but if that's true, I mean, how serious is the situation? I remember Larry McKinney, when we had the discussion on Menhaden, saying we want to get the patient before it gets to the ER.
Well, and certainly it's serious, and that's why we're here. But I don't think I think we can put it in our normal regulatory framework and go through our normal processes so that basically next September, September from now, when we would go through our normal statewide hunting fishing process, and that rule would take effect September 1 of 2009. We believe that will help this fishery. I can say that some of the recent trends in the recreational, you saw the one bag stain recruitment basically ticked up fairly rapidly there in 2007 or 2006, and we've seen that now in the fishery in 2007. So, you know, there's even a little sign that maybe the environmental conditions got right and we had a little better recruitment than we have had in recent years, last year or actually 2 years ago now.
Well, on the chart, this percent of commercial flounder landings by month, I don't think there's one on recreational by month, but would it mirror the commercial landings, which are heaviest in October, November, and December?
Yes. Basically, it may spread itself out a little bit more, but the real opportune time, even in the recreational fishery, is when they're escaping through those passes and they're going from the bay to the Gulf. So it will mirror that very closely.
But you don't think that any action should be taken now to reduce catches this fall?
Well, certainly that's up to y'all's purview, and we might have to ask Ann about what our possibilities are in that respect. But, our viewpoint is that we believe we can work within the statewide hunting and fishing process, and we can, we can work with that and have that in effect by September of 2009.
So to Commissioner Duggan's point, at this point, we don't think we're in a critical biomass state of emergency where we need to do something sooner.
No, we're certainly lower than we'd like to see it, but I don't think we're in an emergency state.
Okay. Commissioner Parker.
Robin, do you have any feel of what the commercial people are doing? Are they staying in business? Are they getting out of the business? Do you have any feel like that?
When it comes to flounder, Commissioner Parker, I don't have a real good feel, though I believe that, like most other commercial fisheries at this point in time, given that they're fairly fuel intensive, now the flounder fishery may be a little different than a shrimp fishery, for instance. But certainly I believe that the overall pressure, the economics pressure they're facing with imports of fish products on the price side of what they're receiving, and then the increase in overall operating costs with fuel and other inputs going up, I would suspect that we're seeing a downward trend, and I think the buyback program and the number of licenses we bought back since the 1999, actually that buyback program didn't start taking effect until really the year 2000. I would think we're seeing those pressures for those people to get out.
Any other questions? We're looking forward to the work of the committees, and I would just ask if we can better understand the regionalization. If we're not going to go that route, why?
Okay.
And I think that'll help us understand the science a little bit more as we go forward as well. And also, I think we need to make sure that we are sensitive to outdoor recreational opportunities, as always, and that we have a known correlation between recreational offtake and biomass or recruitment before we consider changing regs. I'm sensitive to the concern about spawning stock biomass as well as recruitment, but I think we need to make sure that our regs, before we start changing regs, that there is a tie to recreational offtake.
We'll certainly be prepared to present that the next
Thank
meeting.
Thank you, Ron. Okay, committee item number 5, rule amendment regarding additional bycatch reduction devices for shrimp trawls.
For the record again, my name is Robin Rikers of the Coastal Fisheries Division. I'm here to basically present to you an action item that will adopt additions to the approved list of bycatch reduction devices. National Marine Fisheries Service, otherwise known as NIMS, approved three new devices on March 14, 2008. This basically allows those devices to be in Gulf shrimp trawls. We've had a previous list of approved devices, and they basically are adding three to their list. If we approve this action through reference to theirs, it will allow use of those three new bycatch reduction devices in our state waters, which, of course, basically makes it a lot easier. Those boats, those Gulf boats, traverse from state to federal and back to state waters as they're doing their fishing, and this would basically allow someone to put the gear in place and leave it in place instead of either confining them just to offshore out past 9 nautical miles or just inshore, near shore, inside of 9 nautical miles. Since the time that the book was published, we've had an additional person weigh in agreement to this and one additional in disagreement, so that brings the total to 7 in agreement and 1 in disagreement. In the disagreement, I could not really ferret out why they were in disagreement based on their comment. So with that, that leaves us with that public comment, and that concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions regarding this.
Straightforward. Thank you, and thanks for all your hard work, Robin. Appreciate it. No
Thank
further
you.
Questions or discussion. I'll place this item on a Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Maybe item number 6, 2008-2009, Migratory Game Bird Proclamation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, Regulations Committee, and we're here to talk a little bit about migratory birds. And this is a kind of the culmination meeting for setting all the final migratory bird regulations for the year. But let's take a little quick recap and touch on what Director Smith mentioned earlier. On June the 27th, we proposed changes to the migratory bird regulations. And Chapter 65, there are a number of sections that have to be open and dealt with during this period of time. So we published those in the Texas Register. Among those, we dealt with the early season regulations, and particularly the one that was the most comment on was the dove seasons. And this is the first time, although gas prices have been creeping up every year, this is the first time there was a lot of noise in the public comment about connecting traveling to and from hunting areas, and the issue of gasoline to the dove hunting, partly because Saturday, September the 20th, creates a two-day weekend opportunity in the South Zone, whereas normally we open it on the Friday after September the 20th. Again, unless the 20th is a Saturday. So we learned something there this time, and we learned something on some of these other issues that we feel like it's appropriate now to go back out with a significant instrument of evaluation and look at what these noise factors really mean when you spread them out to the broad population of dove hunters. And we intend to do that this fall and winter, and come back to you along the way reporting on what we are learning from that. We're hearing a little bit about whether or not it's appropriate to seek a Friday opening date for the dove season in all of the zones. I have already worked with the Fish and Wildlife Service for the South Zone to establish an opportunity to open it on the Friday nearest September the 20th, but not earlier than September the 17th, which gives us an opportunity when the 20th hits on a Saturday or Sunday or Monday to have that flexibility to open it a little earlier. This is new for us. And we'll have to work that through the Flyway Council and Fish and Wildlife Service in the coming year and hopefully have that in place.
But not for this year.
Not for this year. Not for this year. And although the one component of this year's regulations, which was the move in that week from the end of the first split to the end of the second split, was the one we were really looking at, because our survey in 2000-2001 indicated in the South Zone there's significant interest in that late season opportunity. And we did confirm through our public comment that there still is significant interest in that. But given we saw several little interactions here with the comment, we opted not to implement that this time, but to incorporate that into the survey instrument and kind of get a broader brush look at these issues and see how they mix and match and make sense. And we will be coming back to you in November and January and March, reporting on the progress of this and what we think it means in terms of needs for some consideration for change. So with that said, July the 29th, the early season regulations were adopted by executive order. And now we're here today to present to you the late season regulations and talk about a little bit about the public comment on late season regulations. Basically, we're looking at another liberal season for waterfowl. We're in the third year of our Hunter's Choice bag test, and this is the final year. Next year will be an evaluation year of all the data that we've got, and we will go back to probably the basic regulation package at that time while those data are being evaluated. We're making some minor tweaks in the goose season, in the western goose zone, as well as the crane season. I will talk to you about that in more detail when I get to that point. So, for the High Plain Mallard Management Unit, which is from Del Rio all the way to the Canadian border, the western half of the central flyway, we get 23 extra days of waterfowl hunting opportunity, duck hunting opportunity. So this year we'll have a 91-day duck season. We'll start out with the youth season on October the 18th and 19th. We'll come back that following weekend with a two-day split, if you will, which is something we've done every year. We have to, for that High Plain Mallard Management Unit to gain extra days, we have to set most of our days after a certain date in the calendar. So we'll come back on the 31st of October and run straight through to the end of the framework, the 25th of January. And in the north and south goose zones, because we have this liberal hunting opportunity, we have been setting the seasons similar in both zones. If we ever go back to a more conservative set of regulations, that's when the zones come into play to set the optimal seasons within a shorter waterfowl season within each zone. So we're looking again at November the 1st to November the 30th for the first split in the duck season, come back on the 13th of December and reopen and run to the end of the framework, which is Sunday the 25th. Bag limits, because of Hunter's Choice experiments, stay exactly the same as they have. We are the only flyway that is getting opportunity to hunt canvasbacks this season. Otherwise, the canvasback season is closed. We had strong support from three other flyways to allow us to finish our season without any regulatory changes. And so we appreciated the support of the other flyways to help us convince the service to maintain our stabilized regs. And that also included not changing our SCALP regulations. SCALP regulations otherwise went to a more conservative package, but we still have two a day. So we have the five bird bag with the species restrictions and the hunter's choice that we've discussed before, and you can see in your information, and otherwise unchanged.
Is it just because our flyways become more stable? I mean, what?
Say this again, sir.
Well, I'm trying to understand why the other flyways would be so supportive of us sticking with these regs. What is it? Go ahead.
Good question. The canvasback population dropped below 500,000, just below 500,000 this year. They have a harvest model that looks at what the allowable harvest is when at different population levels. At below 500,000, the allowable harvest was about 24,000 and change in canvasbacks nationwide. Under Hunter's Choice, we, the Central Flyway, has been harvesting about 15,000 canvasbacks. So you don't have but 10,000 more canvasbacks in the allowable harvest. So otherwise, the service would have closed the canvasback season nationwide, except that because the Hunter's Choice option may have a fruitful future for all flyways, the other three flyways have been very supportive of us completing this this experiment unchanged and uninterrupted, so that we have that data to look at and see what the merit of Hunter's Choice bag turns out to be.
And
for all flyways.
When is Hunter's Choice experiment up? I mean, is there a year that it ends, and then we measure?
I'm having trouble hearing you.
Oh, I'm sorry. I speak more. The Hunter's Choice is maybe I've lost track of it. It's going to go so many years, and then it's going to be measured. In other words, other flyways are not doing it. We are doing it.
Yes, we're the only flyway doing it. It's a three-year bag experiment.
Okay.
And this is the end of that three-year cycle. So we'll finish it this year, evaluate it through next year. Part of that evaluation is a big survey of our waterfowl hunters in the Central Flyway to get their feedback on whether they liked it or didn't like it.
Okay. So that'll go on this year in our flyway.
Yes.
And then we'll have some measurements.
Yes. Well, I think I jumped ahead here. The Western Goose Zone. The Western Goose Zone will open on for light geese and dark geese on November the 8th and run through February the 8th. And we have a full Canada goose bag limit, one white front bag limit with a possession limit of twice the daily bag. And then, of course, light geese, we have a 20-bird bag, no possession limit. That's part of the issue of the overpopulation of light geese. The Eastern Goose Zone, again, will run from, it runs similar to the waterfowl season. It'll run November 1 through January the 25th. All three of the goose seasons will open on November the 1st, with the exception that the white front season is a 72-day season with a two-bird bag. That means it has to close on January the 11th. So that is the only one of the goose seasons in the Eastern Goose Zone that doesn't mirror the duck season. And you can see the bag limits in your package there. For the falconry season, the High Plain Mallard Management Unit, the regular gun waterfowl season uses up all 107 days with the teal season and the regular duck season, so there's no extended season for falconry. We don't use up all of the 107 days available in the north and south waterfowl zone, so we have a little bit of a falconry season from the 26th of January to February the 9th. Three-bird daily bag. Sandhill cranes. We have three zones of sandhill cranes, and that's primarily because of the migration of hoopers. And we allow the fly-through in zones B and C for hoopers to get to around us. We have a sandhill crane season in the western in zone A that mirrors the other waterfowl season, so that for the first time, I think, in a number of years, we'll have crane season and our goose seasons all running concurrently with each other, and that'll improve a hunter opportunity in zone A. And again, in zone B and C, we've configured those dates to allow the fly-through of hoopers to a ranch. We are still in the light goose conservation order, the Western Goose Zone. The day after the goose season closes on February the 8th, we open the conservation order on February the 9th and runs to March the 29th. Same is true for the Eastern Goose Zone. We open it up the day after the regular goose season closes and run it to March the 29th. Understanding that most of the conservation order opportunity is in the first 3 weeks of the of that season, because we're getting in that migration shuffle in February, where we start moving north. We've had public comment that was very supportive this year of all of our proposals. for the duck season, and we had 118 supported, 32 in opposition to one or more components of the proposal. Geese, we had a 99-31 split, Sandhill Cranes 44-10. That concludes my presentation and request to move this to the agenda for tomorrow, and I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Thanks, Brian.
Dan.
Questions?
Mr. Bevel. Looking back at the duck page,
from what I'm reading, we can take five green heads.
We can take five mallards in our flyway.
If they are.
If they're green heads. The mallard hen is part of the aggregate bag of the hunter's choice bag. And that mallard hen is in the hunter's choice bag to buffer the other birds, the other less abundant birds in there, like pintail and camelback and mottled up. So we can only take one mallard hen in our bag, but we can take five green heads.
Okay. But in your bag, you can't take... Can you take one mallard hen and five green heads, or one mallard hen and four?
We have a total bag of five ducks.
Okay, so it's one and four.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Sure, Doug.
Is there any reason to differentiate between the north zone and the south zone in your consideration of adjusting the opening day to help folks out on travel costs? And this year, for example, September 1 falls on a Monday. People lose the benefit of the whole Labor Day weekend. I just wonder if you're going to have these ongoing discussions with USF&W about adjusting it to the south zone. Is there a reason not to consider the same logic for the north zone?
Well, that's something we control. The thing we didn't control is the opening day of the south zone. That's set in federal regulation, and so for us to get any flexibility on the south zone opener, we have to change the regulation. Otherwise, you can start hunting migratory birds on September the 1st. And so we traditionally, and I think this goes back to 1918 when the Migratory Bird Treaty Act was passed, Texas has been opening dove season on September the 1st. So it would be a major, major decision to change that opening date.
But my question is it treaty or is it USF&W regulation that precludes opening the season prior to September 1?
Treaty.
Okay.
Well, your question is also, could we consider, instead of opening on Monday, the following weekend and tacking it onto the back, right?
Well, I was more focused on
the other way.
Yeah. Because so many people say,
we can't move.
Yeah, but,
okay.
Another question regarding that. When does the white wing season in Mexico begin?
Commissioner Bivens, off the top of my head, I don't know, but it can't begin before September the 1st, if I'm remembering correctly.
It's my recollection that they allow some type of dove shooting in Mexico prior to September 1st.
Now they may. I would have to go back and look at their regulations specifically to see if they allow it in mid-August. I don't know whether Pete Flores may have a feel for that or not, but
it's August the 1st.
Mike and his travels may know that.
Mike.
Yeah. For the record, I'm Mike Berger, Director of the Wildlife Division. I think you are correct. They start in Mexico many times. I think in the middle of August sometime. I don't know when that is, but my understanding that we have a number of these treaties. We have a treaty with Canada. We have a different treaty with Mexico. I think our September 1st start date is with the treaty with Canada, and that the treaty with Mexico does not have that start date. But we in the United States are tied to the September 1st opening date for migratory birds because of the treaty with Canada. But since that date is not in the Mexican treaty, the Mexicans can start earlier.
Well,
We need to renegotiate our treaty.
We also have a treaty with...
Turn that over to you.
We also have migratory bird treaties with Japan and the Soviet Union. So
yeah.
For different reasons.
And just to give you a quickie on why there's not any interest at the U.S. level in going back to that treaty and trying to get flexibility. Every time the September 1st falls on Labor Day, we always get a little noise about opening and why can't you open it on the 30th. But when you go into a treaty negotiation, that is a State Department endeavor. They lead it. Mm-hmm. And with the Department of Interior being associated with it, and then members from each of the flyways being participants on that team. And you may go in with something real simple like opening on Saturday the 30th, and then these other countries have their issues that they want to deal with, and all of a sudden you don't get your Saturday the 30th, but you get steamrolled on some other things, and it's a long, arduous process that was last pursued in the 90s on some little changes. And I knew some of the guys that were involved in that, and they said, never again do we want to go back and do this. So that's just a...
Careful what you mentioned.
Mr. Chairman?
Please.
Just quickly, because I haven't read, do the bag limits and the conservation order for these light geese, is it making any appreciable difference in the breeding grounds that we know of?
Yes and no. Yes and no. We're dealing with a species and snow geese and Ross's geese to some extent that have become exceedingly adaptable. And so I think the answer is we are harvesting more light geese than we've ever harvested. We've slowed the population growth, and probably some of the population growth that is tied to certain breeding areas has actually declined, but they keep pioneering into new breeding grounds, and it's those new breeding grounds and where those birds migrate to that's still part of that population growth. So we've only been partially successful.
Any other questions? Okay, so as a quick recap on what Mr. Smith said about Dove, so we're going through an expanded scoping process to look at Dove statewide for the next regulatory cycle.
Yes.
Correct? Okay. Great. Thank you.
And then, of course, tomorrow I will only be speaking to the late season regulations that are to be adopted.
Yes. Thanks, Ronald.
Thank you.
Okay, no further questions or discussion. I will place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Item number 7, commercial non-game regulations. Dr. Matt Wagner.
Good morning, Commissioners. My name is Matt Wagner. I'm Program Director for Wildlife Diversity. We're coming to you this morning with some relatively minor changes to our commercial non-game permit program. In March, staff received permission to publish the following changes to our commercial non-game regs, and there are three. First, to extend the grandfather period for possession of prohibited non-game for non-commercial use to November 2010. And this is for people that had non-game in possession before we put our new rules in place in October. So we want to extend that grandfather period to get more information from those that are currently possessing non-game for non-commercial use. Secondly, we want to allow for the possession and captive breeding of prohibited non-game from out-of-state sources. For those that are importing into Texas prohibited non-game, we want to allow for the captive breeding of those animals. And lastly, we want to remove three species from our prohibited list. These were erroneously put on the list: corn snake, house mouse, and rough-footed mud turtle, these species are either non-native or protected under other rules, such as a mud turtle, which is a threatened species in Texas. We had 12 public comments. 8 were in support and 4 were in opposition. The main objections were that the species in general that are on the prohibited list, there's over 180 species on that list. Folks didn't agree with that list. They wanted to commercialize some of those animals. The regulations were not strict enough in some cases. There was no need to extend the grandfather period, and then clarification on some subspecies that these rules cover. So our recommendation tomorrow will be to adopt the amendments that we just discussed. So are there any questions? Be happy to try to answer them.
Thank you,
Matt. Well, Matt, no, we do have to ask you. Said it was a non-native species, the house mouse.
Right. Yeah, just like...
I knew you were going to get this question.
You know, there are so many non-native animals in our environment today. House mouse can be very common throughout the state. We don't have the authority or we don't regulate non-natives, no matter if it's a mouse or something else. So in this case, there's just no need to prohibit the commercialization of those animals. They're being used in all kinds of lab experiments and whatnot. So.
Okay.
Another question? Okay, thanks, Matt. All right. No further questions or discussion. I'll place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. And Mr. Chairman, we've concluded our business.
Well, we've got to over to Mr. Finance. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First order of business is the approval of the minutes from the May 21st and July 17th, 2008 committee meetings, which have already been distributed. Is there a motion for approval?
So moved.
Commissioner Friedkin, we have a second. Commissioner Bevins, seconds. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries. Committee item number one is the land and water plan update. Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chairman, just in the interest of time, I'm going to go ahead and defer my comments to the presenters today. Everybody's presentations consistent with key goals in the plan, and so we look forward to your review and discussion on those items. Thanks.
Thank you. Committee item number two is a financial overview. Ms. Mary Fields.
Good morning, Commissioners. For the record, I'm Mary Fields, Chief Financial Officer, and I'm here to provide the financial overview. I've got several items to cover this morning with you. We'll start off with the revenue and budget status report for fiscal year 2008. I'll review the proposed fiscal year 2009 operating and capital budget, update you on our legislative appropriations request, or LAR, update for fiscal years 2010 and 11, and we'll wrap it up today with the annual review of the budget and investment policies. So let's go ahead and start off with the 2008 revenue and budget status. When comparing the state park receipts for continued operations through June 30th, at $29.9 million, we're up 10.4%, or $2.83 million over last year's collections at the same time. All of the categories of park receipts exceed the prior year at this time. The most notable are in the entrance fees and facility fees. And I'm really proud of the state parks revenue performance here. It's just outstanding. There were very high expectations placed on us by the legislature, and the parks are certainly meeting the challenge, and I just really want to publicly congratulate them for that. It's just gone extremely well. Our boat revenue as of June 30th is $16.6 million. This is down just a couple of percent by $295,000 compared to last year at this same time. The decline in revenue is related to mainly to boat registration, and that's down by almost 4%. But the revenue for the titling and the sales tax is actually up. We do continue to transfer 15% of the registration and titling revenue to Fund 64, and that amounts to over $2.1 million based on revenues through June. Our license sales revenues are also up as at the end of June by 2.9% or $2.4 million, totaling $87.1 million. All categories of revenue are higher than the previous year, except the resident hunting is slightly down and other items are also slightly down. Just in correlating and looking at the number of licenses sold, at 2.78 million, we're up 6.5% as of the end of June. As you can see detailed there on the side of the slide, hunting is slightly down by 0.8%. Fishing is up by 9.1%. Combo sales are also up by 2.9%. We have talked about this earlier in the year. I think maybe some of the hunting numbers, the license population may be heading more toward combo type licenses versus just hunting. So I'm seeing an offset there. When comparing our 2008 revenue collections as of the end of June to our annual revenue estimates, we continue to do well and we should meet our revenue targets. With 83% of the fiscal year elapsed, you can see we've collected 98.9% of our Fund 9 Game Fish and Water Safety Funds, 83.6% of our State Park Funds, and the Local Park Fund is at 88.9%. And then the other category is at 187.7%. There is one fund in there that is doing exceptionally well, and that's driving that percentage. It's the Artificial Reef Fund. Moving into the next area here, our overall budget has increased by over $11.7 million since March, and that takes our budget to $461.2 million. Budget adjustments made during April, May, and June are summarized on this slide. The largest category of adjustments relates to the increase of the budget in relation to the riders, and that's basically we did bring in our additional revenue above the controller's biennial revenue estimate there according to Rider 27. So you're seeing that adjustment to the budget. Another sizable adjustment was just to carry forward some unexpended balances, most of that related to grants, and then there were also a couple pretty large grants that we brought into the budget. In reviewing our 2008 budget versus expense, we have 39.5% of the budget remaining, and this is with 17% of the fiscal year remaining. Most of our operational budget categories are basically on track. There are two notable budget variances that have caused our expenditures to be a bit lower and behind budget. First, the capital construction projects, primarily relating to state park critical repairs, are behind due to the delay of the issuing of the bonds. And I believe Steve will be giving you an update on the progress of all of that a little bit later in the Finance Committee presentation. Secondly, a large amount of local park grants and other grants are still in process and were being evaluated. And tomorrow, you'll see several of those grants up for action by the Commission. That concludes the 2008 status update. Are there any questions there before I move? Yes.
Commissioner.
On the artificial reef numbers, can you tell me what that is, the amount?
Just one moment, please. Well, I had that number right in front of me, and now I'm having trouble finding it. The collections on the artificial reef are at $3.6 million, and I believe some of that has to do with donations and grants that were brought into that fund.
What?
The collections in the artificial reef fund are at $3.6
million. I got that.
And that, I believe that it's due to some donations and grants that have been placed into that fund.
Okay. Are those funds, they have strings on them, like have to be matched or anything like that?
I believe most of the artificial reef funds are primarily donations, and they do have to be utilized in accordance with the requirements of that fund for artificial reef. I don't have a lot of specific detail. Robin?
If I could, for the record, Robin Rikers with Coastal Fisheries Division. No, Commissioner Parker, those donation funds aren't required for us to get a match to be able to expend them in any way. We can go ahead and use that money without any sort of match requirements.
Thank you, Robin.
Any other questions?
Any other questions, then? We will go ahead and move into the 2009 operating and capital budget. On the agenda for the budget today, I will recap our process of preparing the operating budget, review the financing for the budget, provide a few summaries, review the capital budget, recap our budgeted full-time equivalents or FTEs, and we'll wrap it up with covering a few key riders. And just also to note, we did have a budget workshop in July where we covered several of these numbers with members of the commission, and none of the numbers have changed since that workshop. So just for y'all's information, we're still right on target with where we were in July. As far as the process, it's similar to what we've done in prior years, so I'm just going to touch on a couple of key points. We did use the appropriations received via the 80th legislature as our starting point. With the appropriations that we received, we were able to establish the operating budgets at or pretty close to 100% of our 2008 base budgets for the division. Next, we allocated exceptional item amounts that were approved via the legislature, and we allocated those to the appropriate division. The divisions that support our agency need to be correctly balanced in funding for our Fund 9 activities that support the resource division and law enforcement versus our Fund 64 activities that support state parks. We do have a methodology and a process for distributing and balancing those funds appropriately. As we have done in past years, the divisions were given the opportunity to request additional funds or supplementals for their budget if the funds came with their own appropriation authority. And a couple of examples of those types of funds would be federal funds or donations or other types of appropriated receipts. All of the supplementals that were requested by the divisions were reviewed by budget staff and approved by executive management prior to adding them to the division's budget. The last point I'll make about the overall process is that we did budget the capital items at 100% of the funding that was available. We do have the authority to increase those line items up to 125%, and we may elect to add some capital at some point during the fiscal year if additional revenues permit. So let's review how the budget was financed. As I mentioned, we start with the amount of appropriations that we receive from the legislature via the General Appropriations Act. You'll recall from last year's discussion, this session was a bit more complicated because some of the appropriations were contingent on bills passing or a certification of funds. And the funds for the bills are actually outlined, the bills are outlined there and riders that appear at the back of the General Appropriations Act in Article 9. The bills did pass, and most of them resulted in additions. There were a couple of reductions to the budget. And they include, as you can see there, House Bill 12 relating primarily to state parks, House Bill 15 for data center consolidation, Senate Bill 3 for water resource management, Senate Bill 997 relating to what we call the party vote bill, SJR 65 and Senate Bill 2033 relating to the voter-approved bond. The state employee salary increases were also contingent on controller certification of the funding, and she did certify those funds. We also have 36 agency-specific riders that limit or direct how our funds can be spent. I'll touch on a few key ones a little bit later in the presentation. And finally, we are capped at the amount of full-time equivalents, or FTEs, at 3,100.1. this next slide kind of just gives you the numbers and crosswalks, what we just talked about. We do start off with the $251.5 million that was in the Act. As I mentioned, all those contingent bills passed, and the total of those bills amounted to a $28.7 million increase to the budget. The state employee pay raises, and this is the 2% on top of the 2% from fiscal year 2008. Those pay raises were $5.7 million. We added federal funds of $7.8 million, and you will see this category increase over the year as additional federal agreements get signed. And we are adding unexpended balances of $76.2 million for construction and land acquisition. I do have a slide on capital a little bit later that will detail out that number for you. Finally, we're estimating our benefits and setting those funds aside for the employee's retirement system, and that's for a total of $39 million. And then there were a few other adjustments resulting in a decrease of $6 million for a grand total of our operating and capital budget at $402.9 million. This is a view of our method of finance for the budget. In looking at this slide, I think it's important to note that we earn 42% of the funding for our budget. That includes our Fund 9 Game Fish and Water Safety Fund at 31% and Fund 64, our state park revenues, at 11%. The remaining funding comes from general revenue, as you can see, at 22%. Our other general revenue dedicated accounts at 4%. The largest of those is our local parks grant fund. And then the other category at 5%, and this section includes basically appropriated receipts. A large part of that are land sale proceeds that we have from Eagle Mountain Lake and the sale of the Game Warden Academy. Federal funds are at 15% and bonds are at 13%. In moving on and just looking at a couple of different ways to summarize the budget, this first one here gives a broad overview of our budget by object of expense. And to give you some perspective on the size of each category, I have included the percent of total. Our salaries and benefits are at about 45% of our budget. This has typically looked like more like 50 to 60%, but because of the size of the capital portion of our budget, it has driven that percentage down a little bit in looking at the overall total. Our operating has really just increased slightly from the prior year, and as you can see, the grants, they're at 5.4%. The capital budget and related debt service is 27% of our budget. These next two slides highlight our budgets by division. You can see again the division's budgets in millions and the percent of total agency budget, just to give you a sense of the size of each of the divisions. This is how the agency really operates with the budget. Each division has a detailed budget that they manage. I'm not going to cover all the numbers here, but I do want to point out that we do continue to run pretty tight on our administration. All of the administrative divisions combined are less than 10% of the total budget. And in your commission, this is the other half of that picture right here. In your commission packet for tomorrow's action, you do have a one-page summary at Exhibit B, which does highlight the division's budget by object of expense. And that's a pretty good summary to see really how the budget got distributed among the divisions. It also includes FTE counts, which we're going to be covering here in a minute. There's also a summary of the agency's budget at Exhibit A, and this is by strategy. And we have 28 strategies, so I didn't put those on the slides, but that's really how the legislature views our budget, and that is in your commission packet for approval tomorrow. That table also, or that exhibit also includes the method of finance, which was on that pie chart that we looked at earlier. In reviewing the division's budget, you may have noted the department-wide budget category, which was pretty sizable at $22.4 million. I have just kind of outlined what the components of that budget are. You can see the largest is debt service. We do have construction in our Fund 9 divisions that we have not distributed yet among the divisions. all those other categories really are categories that support the agency overall, and so we just roll them up into what we call department-wide. Moving into the capital budget, here I have just provided an overview by category. And in looking at this, the first column are the base amounts that we were able to add into the budget. And then the second column are additions via Rider 20. This rider allows us to grow our capital items for federal or other funds that are designated for a specific capital purpose. Finally, there's unexpended balances there that are going to be carried forward from fiscal year 2008. The land acquisition, again, relates to the sale of Eagle Mountain Lake. And then a good portion of the construction relates to the unissued bonds for state park repairs, critical repairs, and that's at $44.1 million of that total. So that takes us to a total capital budget of $101.1 million. Next, recapping our FTEs. The gold text there shows our FTE cap. You can see it's the same as it was last year. And then in the white text, I'm showing how we actually budgeted those FTEs for 2008 and 2009. We do budget our FTEs above the cap limit because we don't have all of our positions filled all at one time. This allows us to post additional positions when we have positions vacant. We will watch to ensure that we don't exceed the FTE cap. This next couple of thought slides, again, just shows you kind of how those FTEs are funded among the divisions. And basically here, what I will say is our state parks are, you know, it's not surprising, they're the highest counted, about 40% of our FTEs. Law enforcement is right behind here at 20%. The resource divisions combined represent about a third of our FTEs, and the remaining 12% goes to administration and communications division.
Mary?
Yes, sir.
How is that cap set and why?
The legislature actually sets the FTE cap, and I think there was some concern in prior years that maybe we had too many state employees on record, and so the legislature elected to look at the agencies and actually cap the amount of full-time equivalent. So they literally, for us to be able to add additional FTEs, if it's already established within the biennium as this is, we have to request to exceed the cap. The commission actually has to make the request to the Legislative Budget Board in the governor's office. We do have an opportunity to ask for additional FTEs during the legislative appropriation request process and in relation to exceptional items, and we do have a request for additional FTEs in some of the programs. But it's basically a legislative type control, I believe. In covering the key riders, we do have several of them. I'm not going to go through these one by one. I did want to just list the audit-related items that we have and just mention that we did receive a lot of additional appropriations this biennium, and we did receive directives on how that money could be spent, as well as expectations that audit recommendations would be implemented, studies would be conducted, and reports would be submitted to the oversight agency. As you know, in fiscal year 2008, we submitted several of those plans and studies, which required approval from the Legislative Budget Board and the Governor's Office prior to the release of funds for a specific purpose. And we'll continue to submit reports, and there's still a couple of studies outstanding that we will perform in fiscal year 2009. Moving into the next riders here are just a few key ones for our agency specifically. Rider 19 allows us to carry forward unexpended balances from the sale of the Game Warden Academy. It directs us to use those proceeds on the new academy, and we are doing that. Rider 20, I mentioned during the capital budget, It basically exempts us from capital provisions for gifts, grants, interlocal, and federal funds that are specified for a specific capital purpose, excluding land acquisition. Rider 22 appropriates all balances and revenues from the sale of TPWD lands to TPWD. Rider 23 requires us to implement recommendations from the Legislative Budget Board that they provided to us during a review that was conducted about a year and a half ago, I believe. Finally, Rider 24 requires us to collect usage statistics such as number of hours of operation on all of our major equipment and to report to the Legislative Budget Board and Governor's Office no later than October 1st of the year for the preceding fiscal year. And that concludes the operating and capital budget part. Are there any other questions before I move into the legislative appropriation request? Okay. Here we go. We pushed send yesterday, by the way, Commissioner Holt. At about 6:45 last night, we did push send, and we did close. Today, we will be sending all the official supporting documents and that sort of thing via email, and it'll go to print, and we'll have it distributed as required, and it'll actually be out on our website by August 25th.
So. I signed it today.
Yes, you did. Thank you.
See how we do. Bam.
So as we move in here, I just want to make a couple of comments about the baseline request for fiscal year 10 and 11. It is based on projected expenditures from fiscal year 2008 and our fiscal year 2009 operating budget, which we just reviewed. Any amounts that we need to request above our base are requested as exceptional items. We do have some of those, which I'll review. We did get directions this time to complete the LAR with 100% of our base amount, but they did require a special schedule that lays out a 10% reduction of general revenue-related funds. And again, and we'll cover a little bit about that, and again, the LAR is due today. So... ta-da, there it is, a very high-level view of our legislative appropriations request. The base request totals $643.9 million, and our exceptional items total $131.9 million, for a total request over the biennium of $775.8 million. And that is a very high-level view of a very detailed document. So next, let's talk a little bit about the exceptional items. They are listed here in priority order. Again, note that these totals are biennial totals as I go through this. So our highest priority exceptional item is to continue our salary equity and total compensation package for the agency. We will be compensating the remaining positions that need salary equity adjustments. We'll be dealing with some of the compression issues that arise when adjustments are made and positions overlap that didn't get an adjustment. And finally, we'll be looking to activate a merit program. The second exceptional item deals with increased operational costs due to rising prices of fuel, commodities, and other service items. The third item is to continue our capital repair program for all TPWD facilities. Our fourth item requests funding and FTEs for several programs to expand public access for quality outdoor recreational opportunities on public and private lands and waters. The fifth exceptional item requests funding and FTEs to improve compliance with the new fiscal controls in state parks and to meet other critical park services needs, just to make sure those are being met while these fiscal controls are also being put in place. The sixth exceptional item is to support information technology initiatives and to deal with increasing data center consolidation costs. The seventh item funds the cost of deploying a turnkey computer system in our law enforcement vehicles. The eighth item is for land acquisition and development to improve access to the outdoors as laid out in our land and water resources conservation and recreation plan. And finally, the ninth exceptional item is to support the governor's border security initiative by placing more game wardens on the Texas border, along with necessary capital equipment and funding their operational needs. So that is also a high-level view of our exceptional items. We will provide more detailed information to the commission and within hearings, and obviously it is in our request as well in more detail. Next here,
Mary, I have a question. On the governor's border security initiative, is that primarily for equipment and other additional items, or what
additional game wardens?
There are, I know in the second year of this request, there will be 25 additional positions, and then there's also, I believe, a helicopter and a few boats that are included within that request.
Okay.
And then just operational and support needs to go
right
along with those wardens.
Okay. Thank you.
This next slide does outline the general revenue-related reduction amounts that were targeted on the 10% reduction schedule. The total reduction amounts to $47 million, with general revenue dedicated at $32.6 million and general revenue at $14.4 million. We did outline 17 different items on the reduction schedule, so I'm not going to cover that entire list with you today. I thought what I would do is just mention that our kind of our overall strategy for that reduction in deciding how we put programs on the list. And basically, the key strategy here was to minimize the impact on our core and high-priority operations as much as possible. And also, we wanted to ensure that our focus remains on our land and water conservation plan initiative and make sure that those priorities can still be fulfilled. So, you know, we've completed the information as required, and we'll see what happens during the session with that schedule. And that concludes the LAR update. Are there any questions there? If not, this is the final segment that I'll be covering today. Annually, we are required to review the budget and investment policy. A copy of these policies, again, are included in your handout for action items for tomorrow's meeting. I'll touch on just a few key points regarding the budget policy. Within that policy, the Commission authorizes the Executive Director to approve and execute necessary expenditures, budget adjustments, and transfers. There are several different types of transactions that are detailed in that policy. Budget adjustments excluding federal grants and bonds that exceed $250,000 do require prior approval from the Chairman of the Commission and the Chairman of the Finance Committee. And as Ann mentioned in her presentation, we have made an addition to the budget policy, and this really is to improve our process of accepting and budgeting donations. We have added a requirement for the Chairman of the Commission and the Chairman of the Finance Committee to accept donations or gifts that exceed $500, basically on a monthly basis. And by doing that, we can go ahead and budget those donations. We still will present all of those donations to the Commission for acknowledgement in every Commission meeting, just as we do now. And I think this will be really a positive change for the various programs and donations associated with them. Moving on to the investment policy, this policy really has not changed since the prior year, but as the governing body of this department, you are required by statute to review this policy annually. All funds administered by Parks and Wildlife are required to be deposited in the state treasury, except for the three funds that are highlighted on this slide. I believe in the packet, in your binder there is one fund that is showing up on your slide that I removed, and that's the Varner Hogg State Park Trust account. We did transfer that to the Texas Historical Commission, so it's not up on the slide in the presentation, but I do think it's still in your book. And while we're not required, all of these funds do really reside in the Treasury except for Operation Game Thief, and those funds are invested in CDs and several bank accounts. Finally here, all the bank accounts must be authorized by delegated investment officers, and they must be properly collateralized, and there are also some specific reporting requirements that are also included in that policy. And with that, that concludes my presentation. Are there any questions?
Any questions, Ms.? Thank you, Mary. That was a very good presentation.
Thank you. I do want to say in closing before I leave the podium here, I do want to thank Lance Goodrum and the budget team that just did an outstanding job on pulling together the operating budget and the LAR this summer. Also, Julie Horsley and her team. Julie just has been wonderful in helping us with the exceptional items, and some of her team helped with revenue collection schedules and riders and all that sort of thing. So they've just really worked hard this summer. The divisions and their coordinators, budget coordinators, have provided a lot of information to us this summer to accomplish all of this, and I just want to thank all of them.
It's a good team effort.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. If there are no further questions or comments, I will place the fiscal year 09 operating and capital budget and the budget and investment policy resolutions portions of this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Committee item number 3 is the internal audit report. Mr. Carlos Contreras is going to make a presentation.
Good morning, Chairman Holt and Commission members. For the record, my name is Carlos Contreras, and I'm the Director of Internal Audit. Since our last Commission meeting, we've been able to complete and distribute 2 reports on the park. Round 2 of the park audits found that we had just one of the 8 parks was fully compliant with procedures outlined in the fiscal control plan and the visitation reporting plan, which were the 2 large areas that we examined during the park audit. Individually, for revenue collection and reporting, we had 5 parks that had implemented the new procedures, and 3 of them had delayed implementation of some of the basic controls. The revenue processes still needed strengthening to prevent occurrence of fraud or theft, and most of the parks needed improvement in the internal control areas of supervision and documentation. On the visitation collection and reporting side, we had 7 of the parks reflected tabulation and recording errors, with most resulting in underreporting of visitation data. 4 of the park errors were considered large enough to have a possible impact on individual park visitation data during the audit period itself. Now, to give a little context to round 2, the audit time, the records that we reviewed were in October, and the the training and the workshops that were conducted were in September. So this was a month after the workshops were conducted.
Carl, I was going to stop you there. This is important, so I need to have an understanding.
Yes.
Okay, it says round 2 park audits.
Right.
In round 1, did we get all the parks audited? And was that the goal? That's what I can't remember.
No, sir. What we've done is there were over 90 parks that we had to look at.
Right.
We're conducting 8 rounds during the fiscal year. And what we've done as far as actual completion and distribution of the reports is through round 3. And actually, as we speak, I think that the round, I'm sure that the round audit, round 4 audit report has been forwarded to Carter and executive management for their review. So we're about halfway through the process.
So each round is just so many parks in each round.
Yes, sir.
Not going back through.
No,
it's the first audit of that particular park.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Round 5 is the one where we went back and had some follow-ups on some of the parks we did earlier.
Okay. Just so everybody in the commission understands, I mean, this would be one of the major issues that we'll have to have discussion about going into January of 09 with legislators, is the audits, the counts, what showed up in the audits, because that's where we got a lot of questioning in the last legislative session. So, okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
When will all of the audits be completed?
Well, all of the field work has been completed through eight rounds, and what we looked at was 82 parks. However, the review process hasn't been completed. We're halfway through there. I was able to work with the LBB analyst and work through the SAL to discuss the intent of the rider. And what we need is representation, at least by one auditor in each of the regions. So what I'm doing is getting some of the other auditors to participate in the review process, and that that ought to bring the rounds 5 through 9 to completion much faster. What was happening is the 14 field auditors were all their work was being reviewed by the two audit managers here, well, in Austin, and that was a little bit of a bottleneck.
Right.
The review process takes some time.
So we will have a full data set prior to the beginning of the legislative session?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
I'd like to ask a question in terms of you guys get really specific with even pennies.
Yes, sir.
And sometimes an audit will show 20 problems that maybe will amount to problems that are small in size, but in the report they come out as problems. If you have, from what you've seen so far, if you have to take a dollar amount of what the state is missing out in revenues through your audits, a round part figure would be.
Well, that's a very difficult question to answer, since each of the parks is specific, you know, has a specific amenities and different entrance fees, things of that nature, and so it's sort of hard to estimate what we're lacking. What I can tell you is everything that's brought forward to the reports has been seen and is a repetitive thing, as opposed to nickel and diming people in the report. And I understand where you're coming from. What we do is when we go through, if there's an instance of perhaps, you know, no double entry or no signature, things of that, and the amount is immaterial for that part, we usually don't bring it forward to the report.
If somebody asked us, like the chairman is concerned, if somebody asked us if we're losing millions, are we?
I'm sorry, I didn't.
If somebody asked us, are we losing millions, are we?
No, I wouldn't characterize that loss as being that great.
I don't hope not. We're big down in Monte Carlos.
So at least we've got it narrowed down to less than.
Oh, right. Okay. I think so.
A lot of our issues, Tony or Antonio, were lack of consistency across the parks. So a big part of what we've done besides bringing the auditors aboard was the fiscal controls and training that was put in place. And that's just kicking in. So a lot of people are, I mean, this is a learning process literally on the, as OJT. And so I think Carlos and his group have done a good job. But really, when Carlos is new in the job, except for the two auditors that have been here for quite a while, everybody else is new. And so, and then the fiscal controls that have been put in place in all the parks are all new to the operations of the parks. So we're in the midst of all of this, literally churning along, and it's truly a learning process.
Commissioner, if I can add something to it, I don't think the issue so much is revenue collection, but it has to do really with segregation of duties and also just documenting all of the decisions and all of the transactions that are happening inside the park. Much of our processes are manual in nature right now. We are in the throes of developing a new revenue documentation and visitation system that you've heard a little bit about called Text Parks that we hope to roll out in the late winter time period. And so we're hoping certainly that automation is going to help that. But I think, you know, to be fair, what Carlos is saying is there are a few sort of patterns that we're seeing throughout these audits that we need to work to address. But revenue collection and those problems of the magnitude that you're talking about is not the issue.
And so when the state asked us to do this, they really weren't concerned about revenue as much as making the process more uniform throughout the state.
Yeah, I think they had some concern about revenue and whether we were documenting all of the visitors coming in and we were collecting revenue for all of those visitors, and then are we consistent in the waivers that we would grant to groups that would come into the park. So I think, to be fair, there was some concern about that.
But not at the numbers that you're talking about. I think it was much more the credibility relative to consistency across the system, I think, was the bigger issue. Thank you, Carl.
In round three, we found that of the 11 parks that we looked at, none of them were compliant. On the revenue side, we had 9 parks that had implemented the procedures and 2 parks still hadn't completely implemented all of the basic controls. The revenue processes still needed strengthening to prevent occurrences of theft or fraud, and all of the parks needed improvement in internal control areas of supervision and documentation. On the visitation side, 3 of the parks collected and reported visitation data correctly during the test period. 5 of the parks reflected tabulation recording errors that were underreported by an insignificant amount. However, there were 3 parks that had visitation errors resulting in underreporting that were considered large enough to be brought forward to the report. And when we looked at the information that we examined at the time, that was from December. So this is a 3 months down the road from the workshop dates that were in September.
Let me ask you, is from a workshop standpoint, how often are we going to have this type of training, you know, for the park system? It's obvious. I mean, we've had a round of workshops. We've still got a lot of work to do to get to where we need to be. And so what kind of going forward, as far as additional training, what are we going to be doing?
Well, currently what we have is in the revenue section of the parks area, there's a resource, there's individuals that can be contacted for guidance and direction specifically related to the fiscal control plan. And what we plan to do, or we're going to participate in as an agency, is the training for the Texas park systems that Carter had mentioned just a minute ago. That's going to be implemented sometime in the spring. Now, that automated system will reduce the amount of actual manual work that has to be done, a number of the logs. It'll create a much better and stronger audit trail for us. And we'll also provide a little more security as far as the stores and the lease concessions, a lot of that revenue that comes in from through those manners.
Commissioner Park.
Carlos, as you are making your way through these parks, round 2, round 3, round 4, are you doubling down, passing that information along to other state parks? We found that Part A and Part C were doing thus and so, and you've got to correct this and be sure everybody else is doing this.
Yes, sir. All the reports...
So that when you get to the end, hopefully, you will have, hopefully, a lot of parts already in compliance with the changes that we are looking for.
Yes, sir. We share a lot of the findings with the regional directors of the parks. And I know, to give you an example, one of the regional directors has the other park superintendents go and at different times audit the parks within her region for this compliance. And they do it independent of ourselves, and so they share a lot of that. The other thing that we do is our auditors, since they're in a region, they'll go to different parks within the same region and then share that information through the regional director of what they found. But again, all of our reports are a matter of public record, so it's we can send them out to wherever we need to.
What you're saying is it's being done bottom up. What about top down?
Well, again, we provide a lot of this information to executive management, and we allow them to review our reports prior to any of the distribution. So I think all of the concerns that are out there in the specific areas, we've noted that.
cost. Can I get Scott just to address that in terms of sort of he and Walt's handling of this?
Commissioners, for the record, my name is Scott Borup, Deputy Executive Director for Operations. To kind of answer several of the questions, Commissioner Parker, yes, it is a top-down effort as well as a bottom-up effort. We work closely with Carlos and his staff early on in the process to be sure that as they go to one park and find different trends and patterns, that that information is passed on to Walt Dabney as the director of the division and the regional directors, who, of course, are the main contact out in the field, as well as sharing that with the local park staff. And so in terms of the specific question, yes, we are looking at that. I would also, relative to a couple of the other questions, remind and particularly renew the new commissioner's recollection that when we went through the state auditor's process, there were four main findings there. Financial controls or fiscal controls were certainly their main concern. Visitation and revenue were the second set of concerns. The third was the way we do capital programs, and the fourth was park management. But the two main areas that these audits came back to us in were in fiscal controls and revenue and visitation measurements. What I can say is that while what you see there says none of the 11 parks, I'm just using that particular slide, were compliant, I think what you would see, what I have been seeing in the reports that come back to me and are passed on to Mr. Dabney, is continued improvement. Just because those parks didn't get 100% compliance doesn't mean they were totally out of compliance in terms of nothing was happening right. It is a relatively new process, as the chairman has mentioned. I think there's a very strong commitment in the State Parks Division from the top down to make sure that this is corrected. In the meantime, it is significant workload and kind of a resource issue right now because all these processes are manual. Many of the things that are out of compliance that I have seen tend to be misdocumentation, things that weren't documented right in this bulk of paperwork that's having to flow around. The new text parks system, which several folks have referenced here, should be online. We're hoping right around the beginning of the session, if not before, and we're hopeful that that will relieve the burden on the staff, and it will also help some of these inadvertent documentation errors decline.
Commissioner, if I just add one thing to it, I've asked with Carlos and Scott and Gene and Walt to get together after the commission meeting to sort of talk about where we are, the sort of recurring patterns that we're seeing in the audits, and what else we can do to help address those and alleviate those problems going ahead. So I do want you to know.
But do you understand what I'm talking about?
Absolutely understand. Absolutely.
So that, you know, the burden begins to diminish before we get to the end because we found these problems up here. Mm-hmm. Are we communicating on down the line?
Yep.
Get these corrected before we get there.
Absolutely. The lessons learned. There's no doubt about it. And that's critically important that we're learning from mistakes and that we're having early on and making sure that other parks have a chance to address those. Now, your point is well taken.
Well, in support of Scott's statements, and this particular slide is a little dated, we've already completed all of the review, and actually the report is ready for distribution. In round four, we found that none of the 11 parks that we took a look at were compliant, but we did find incremental improvement in revenue collection and reporting. We had three parks that exhibited a high degree of implementation that had a minimum amount of errors that we found that never made it to the report. Four of the parks had not implemented still some of the basic controls related to the revenue collection and reporting. We still found that revenue processes need strengthening to prevent any occurrence of risk or theft, and internal controls at the park-operated stores also needed improvement. Now, as far as visitation, four of the parks collected and reported the data for the 11 correctly during the test period. And we found that at three parks, there were tabulation and recording errors that resulted in misreporting visitation data by an immaterial amount that never made it to the report. But four of the parks actually had errors resulting in both over and under reporting of visitors that was large enough to be considered to be included in the report.
And stop you there, because some would over-report and some would under-report. In other words, there was not a consistent one way or the other.
Yes, sir.
It's not a system problem, then it's an operational problem.
Right. And we have to take into consideration the records that we reviewed at this time were from February.
So that's right, right after the training, then again.
Yeah, the first round two was in October, yeah. Round three was in December, and round four is from February. But and I can't speak definitively, but when I've talked to the audit managers, they see in the review process that's going on for these later rounds that that there has been an improvement, you know, in the implementation of the controls.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I think, like when on some of the slides here, when you say that none of the parks that were audited were compliant, you probably mean none were 100% compliant.
None were 100% compliant.
But within that, there is some good, and I think I'd like to see some of the good also on some of the slides versus none were compliant, which may send the wrong signal to people that may not fully understand what those slides mean. I know that when Medicare does an audit at a nursing home, if the nursing home gets gigged for not giving a vitamin on time, it's very different than if they didn't give a blood thinner on time. Two totally the same, it's reported the same way, but with two very different implications.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe as time goes on, we can develop a system on the severity of scores and say two scored very bad, two scored okay, and two scored substandard, or some kind of nomenclature.
Yeah.
Where it's very hard for everybody to do 100%, because nobody will ever get to 100%, especially with these guys that count pennies.
That's a good point.
Well, I can certainly discuss with Carter any changes that we need in our reporting structure, and we can take that into consideration as long as they fit with our professional standards. I don't have any problem with changing any of the reporting. Rounds 5 through 7, the field work, actually round 5 through 8, all the field work has been completed, and the work papers are in the review process for now. And like I said, we have redirected some of our resources to participate in the review process so that we can get the rounds 5 through 8, those reports out before the beginning of the session. The last one that we did was round 8. It consisted of 13 audits. What we did is we've in a discussion with Carter and the deputy executive directors, we've decided to scope out 11 of the parks that didn't have any revenue or relied on donations or were below a certain threshold that we had all talked about previously. So what we did for the last round was we took the final 9 parks that hadn't been audited. And what we did is we rolled in 2 follow-up audits, 2 from round 1 and 2 from round 3, to get an idea of whether in that interim they had implemented the processes and there was an improvement in what we saw. Additional audits that we're working on, 2 of them are concession audits, Cedar Hill State Park and Eisenhower State Park. Both of those we expect to release the report in the first quarter of FY09, we're in the process of getting our final comments and responses from management. We're going to conduct an audit of the Central Reservation Center for the State Parks, but what we've done with that is done our planning, and we're going to go ahead and carry it over into 09, because the implementation of the Texas Park System that's coming in the spring is going to affect the processes, the way they do business. So we're just going to hold off and see what changes occur to their basic processes as a result of the implementation of that system. And one other audit that we're working on, and we're nearly completed, is the sand and gravel audit. And we are looking at Richmond Materials and Brazos Sand. And they've had some problems with payments, so we're up to about $130,000 that we found that we'll recoup for the agency. We have some advisory projects that we've participated in. One of them, I guess the most important one we've had lately,
is being the liaison with the state auditor's office and any external audit or oversight agencies. I'm a member of the advisory committee for information technology within the agency. We also participate on the Texas Park System management group. I've been involved to a certain extent with the project business information system development, and I've also worked with IT on the data consolidation services by attending meetings and providing comments, providing any guidance that I can. We've had one investigation that had to do with recreational grants. Internal Affairs asked us to look at some of the records of a grantee. We've completed our examination, and we went ahead and shared the results with Recreational Grants and Internal Affairs, and they're moving forward to complete that report. Professional service, one of the staff members, David Heater, completed his tenure as a board member and treasurer for ACFE, the Association of Certified Fraud Examiners, for 2008. And Mr. Heater also retired the 14th of this month after 35 years of service with Parks and Wildlife. I completed my tenure as a board member and treasurer for the Information Systems Audit and Control Association. And I was elected the reporter for the SAFE Committee, which is a subcommittee of the State Agency Coordinating Committee. We were able to get a group membership for the Institute of Internal Auditors for our whole staff. We discussed the audit charter revisions, and I've got a tacit approval from Carter to go ahead and proceed. We'll have internal audit policies and procedures. We'll have that finalized here for the beginning of FY09. There are discussions currently with Carter and management about a fraud, waste, and abuse email box and possibly a phone number to help augment what was RP36 back in July of 2004, which is the executive order to try to control fraud, waste, and abuse. And finally, what I do is we monitor our CPE requirements as people get trained, and that's part of our professional standards. And we also make sure that we report all the hours taken to the applicable oversight agencies. I'm open for any questions you may have.
Were you given an audit plan to use in connection with the state park audits, or is that something that you and others in your department?
No, sir. When I came on the job, the audit plan for FY08 had already been developed by Dennis, my predecessor, Dennis O'Neill, and they had already actually conducted the round one audits and gotten the report out when I came on. So I've been here through round two through the current activity.
Well, going forward, would you, having gone through this several rounds of using this plan, would you make or propose changes to it in the future?
Yes. Yeah. We've already been discussing that. And actually, what we plan to do is in consultation with executive management, we're going to see whether we need to go do some follow-ups at some of the more problematic parts that we found. What we're also going to do is increase our coverage of the lease concession audits. Those are the concessions work in concert with the parks and bring in revenue. And so we're also examining those. That's why we did the two at Cedar Hill and Eisenhower. And we're going to go ahead and incorporate some of those. In addition, I think there's going to be some work that we need to do at headquarters that covers the visitation and revenue areas. And that's going to be, you know, in concert with the management group for the parks at headquarters.
Any other questions? Russ, thank you for your presentation. Appreciate the work you guys are doing, and look forward to seeing improvement in all those areas.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Carlos.
Committee item number four, update on the Sunset Commission review of the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. Mr. Gene Carty.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, for the record, my name is Gene McCarty. I'm a Deputy Executive Director of Administration. The item before you today is just an update on our sunset review process. Before I get started, I'd like to introduce several people in the audience here. Harold Stone with Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, our Director of Intergovernmental Affairs, is also serving as our liaison for the sunset review process. And we also have, from Sunset Commission, we have Steve Hobson and Chloe Liebernick with us today. And you may have all had the opportunity to meet them at this point, or you will have, because they will be conducting hopefully some interviews with each of you through the process. Today, I'd like to just kind of give you an update on where we are in the sunset process and kind of give you a little bit of an idea of where it's going. To start with, just let me kind of review the timeline of sunset. The sunset review itself started back in August when we turned in our self-evaluation report. At that particular point in time, Sunset Commission began reviewing all the agencies that were in sunset for this coming year and kind of set out a time schedule. And we, Texas Parks and Wildlife, was placed into the second round of reviews. So if you see from August and of 07 until May of 08, we were kind of in limbo as they reviewed a whole bunch of other agencies. They actually began their preliminary review process in May with a preliminary overview of the agency, working with myself and Carter and Scott. And then at the same time they went through and reviewed every division. And then in June through August, they did secondary reviews. They went down to the programmatic level within each division. In June and August, they also began conducting site visits around the state. August through October, with the period we're in right now, they will be conducting a lot of scoping meetings with constituents and leadership, and that's a period of time when they'll be talking with you and many of our constituents around the state, just getting an idea of what those people who we are serving think about the function and operations of Parks and Wildlife Department. In November, they will be working on their staff report, basically making their recommendations or developing their recommendations. Those recommendations will be presented to the Sunset Commission on December the 16th and 17th of 2008 in the public hearing for Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. And then on January the 14th, 2009, the decision meeting of the Sunset Commission will occur, and that will basically be whether the Sunset Commission adopts the staff report or makes any recommended changes to that report. Just in summary of where we are, Sunset staff has held 36 different scoping meetings within Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, including an agency overview, 9 preliminary divisional overviews, and 26 secondary overviews meeting with agency program staff. They've conducted 5 field trips visiting 14 Parks and Wildlife field locations, including Kerr Wildlife Management Area, LBJ State Park, Enchanted Rocks State Natural Area, the Lareda the Border Joint Enforcement Project, where they were involved in lake and land patrols, Falcon State Park, Chaparral Wildlife Management Area, A.E. Wood Fish Hatchery, Government Canyon, the Coastal Fisheries Field Station at Port O'Connor, Sea Center, Coastal Fisheries at Dickinson, law enforcement offices in Lamarck, our border security and port security programs in Houston, Galveston, and Texas City, and Prairie Haines Ranch. So you can see from the cross section of places that they visited, and they've done a very thorough job of just taking a good cross section of the agency. What's next? As I indicated, they're going to be continuing their scoping work with constituents and with leadership and yourself.
They're going to be developing issues, and so the next couple of months are going to be pretty critical for them kind of homing in on what they think are the key issues that they would that they find with Texas Parks and Wildlife. We'll have an opportunity to review those issues with them, kind of tell them our side of the story, talk about what those issues are, maybe work with what might be some statutory changes that could address those issues. Then they will develop the staff report, as I indicated, and that staff report will be submitted to Sunset Commission on December the 16th at that public hearing. And then in January, they will have their final decision meeting. That's kind of it as where we are. As I said, both Steve and Chloe are here, and hopefully you'll have an opportunity to visit with them in the next couple of days and ask any questions of them or any questions of myself or Harold. If I can answer any questions, let me know.
Thank you. Any questions for Gene? Thank you for your presentation.
Thank you.
Committee item number 5 is the capital program update and bond project review. Mr. Steve Weston, I'll make the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, commissioners. For the record, I am Steve Weston, Director of Infrastructure Division. I'll be presenting this morning a very brief end-of-year update of our capital program. Commissioners, I'm really pleased to report that we continue to make great progress in the implementation of our FY06 general obligation bond issue. This was made available to us back in April of 06. We received a little over $18 million for 71 projects for all divisions. This is the only remaining bond issue that was previously appropriated to us prior to this current fiscal year. We still anticipate that the majority of these bond projects will, with the exception of two, will be under construction and the funds fully encumbered prior to the start of the legislative session.
Of this 18 million.
Yes, sir.
Right.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Great progress with that. Those two projects that still remain or still be ongoing were delayed during the design process, but the good news is that those projects will be under construction contract by March or early April, and along with the remaining or unexpended balances of the bond issue, we expect these funds to be fully expended by the end of the fiscal year. Of 2009, so there'll be no or very minimal UB going into the next biennium for these funds. So we're very grateful for the support and pleased with the progress of closing out this bond issue. If you recall, commissioners, we were very fortunate to be appropriated for our current biennium, the 08-09 biennium, $69.12 million of new bond revenues for state park repairs. That included $17 million for repairs in state parks from the old unauthorized Prop 8, as well as $52.12 million of new bond appropriations from Prop 4 that was approved by the Texas voters in November. These funds provide a little over $27 million for state park repairs and $25 million, as you recall, for the Battleship Texas. Just to give you a little idea of summarize our delivery strategy for these projects, as we've discussed in the past, these 94 projects, we took a very careful and very comprehensive look and adopted a new methodology for implementing these projects, which is now well underway. Out of the 94 projects, we bundled together or packaged 63 of those projects into three large regional construction projects. We're now in the process of evaluating the design consultants and anticipate awarding the design contracts for those shortly, and I'll share that in the next slide. But that methodology is one that we are very hopeful and anticipate, you know, success in accelerating the delivery and the implementation of these projects. 17 of the projects were we elected to be accomplished through our force account program. This is our in-house construction program. Those projects will get underway in September. We'll actually start construction of those projects. A little under $5 million of those 17 projects on force account. There were 13 of the projects in the package or in the program that really just didn't fit into those bundles. So we'll be executing those using traditional design, bid, delivery methodologies, using competitive seal proposals, and implementing those immediately as well. And so we anticipate, again, success in stepping up the delivery of these projects. Just to give you an idea about what that schedule looks like, as you well know, on May 20th, our business plan for these projects was approved by the LBB. And I'm very excited, very pleased to report that since our last meeting on July 17th, our bond issue was approved by the Texas Public Finance Authority and the Bond Review Board. Those monies we expect to begin receiving this month, and in fact next week, anticipating the first $5 million, a $5 million issue to set these projects in motion. As I mentioned before, we expect to award the design contracts for those bundled projects in early November this year, and start construction for the force account in September, and then the construction will start being phased out, and it will be under construction by November 2009 for all the projects, and then expect completion beginning in early 2010 through the next year. So we're very optimistic again that this is going to provide us with opportunities to response to the slight delay we incurred at the beginning, but to catch up and get these dollars spent, and some really good work accomplished in the state park system. Commissioners, if I may just shift gears slightly, lastly to brief you on the Battleship Texas, on this remaining $25 million project. We received our engineering report on the condition of the Battleship Texas on May 15th. That, after evaluation of the findings in that report, we presented our project plan that outlined our steps in going forward in implementing this project that was submitted to the LBB on July 11th. And we're waiting now for their approval. And pending their approval, we are prepared to rapidly move forward as necessary, move forward with the implementation of the project. Assuming that we get LBB approval in the near future, we can anticipate as early as September starting the request for financing, and then depending on the scheduling and actually the approval process here, we could anticipate going before the Bond Review Board as early as September, as late as November, and then receiving approvals from them and be able to obtain the issue of the bonds as early as October or as late as December, again, pending the subsequent approval here of LBB. So we are poised to go forward with this project. Anticipate going through an RFQ process to select a qualified marine engineering firm to help us through the design process and all the clearances necessary to be able to implement this project as well, and finally address the long-term preservation needs of the ship.
Yeah, leaving it in place in dry docking, essentially.
Yes, sir. That is still our intention. That we believe to be the best interest of this ship and of this very important historic landmark to create and build a permanent dry berth at the present slip there at San Jacinto to take it out of water and preserve it there.
And in our studies that we've done, we think the $25 million is going to cover it.
Yes, sir, we do. We are very optimistic. Yeah, the engineer, as a supplement to his condition assessment report, developed, and I shared with you in the last meeting in May, several different options that we believe can be managed very effectively within this $25 million budget. And in addition, please be aware that the Battleship Texas Foundation has pledged, and we have appropriation authority for an additional $4 million. So we're looking at about a $29 million budget for the dry berthing and additional repairs that we think we're going to be able to accomplish for the ship. That concludes my presentation, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thanks, Steve. Do you want to make some comments?
I did want to add one comment just for clarification. Steve mentioned it, but if and when these bonds are issued and we go forward with the project, there are a couple important components that would happen, obviously, before the construction started there, and those include the cultural and natural resource clearances. And so I just wanted the commission, particularly the new folks on the commission, to understand that in any project that we do on any publicly owned land at Texas Parks, which our land is at Texas Parks and Wildlife, through the infrastructure division, that process is well-defined both at the state and the federal levels. So there is a permitting process that we have to go through to ensure that we're not going to negatively impact cultural or natural resources there, and that if that does become an issue, that we address that issue in an appropriate fashion, either through mitigation or changing our plans or whatever. But just because the bonds are issued and we begin to move forward does not mean that we're just going to go out there and start tearing up the landscape to do this. And I wanted that to be clear, particularly to new commissioners.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, this committee has completed its business.
Moving on to
conservation.
Commissioner Bivens. So,
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Would you like me to pass it again?
I'll leave it in your able hands. Thank you very much. I would like to call the Conservation Committee to order, and our first order of business is the approval of the prior minutes. Is there a motion for approval?
So moved.
Mr. Martin, second. Second by Hickson. Thank you very much. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Hearing none, motion passes. Committee item number one, land and water plan update. Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Chairman. First and foremost, I just want to thank you for helping to enable that very successful second Wind and Wildlife Conference in the Panhandle that was sponsored with a
big turnout.
Huge turnout. We had 250 attendees representing wind developers, government agencies, a lot of private landowners. Huge proliferation of interest in that, particularly following on the heels of the Public Utilities Commission's decision to invest another $5 billion in supporting infrastructure to help enable that. So I think it was a perfect role for the department to help in providing the outreach to landowners, help to bring best available science, which right now is very limited in this arena and is an area that we certainly need to strengthen inside the department as landowners are being confronted with choices as to whether or not to proceed with wind energy development on the property. But those kind of conferences, I think, are essential and a very, very important role for the agency to be playing. So thank you for all your help.
You're welcome. Very important conference.
A couple other things. Robin, in his presentation on the Southern Flounder, talked a little bit about Galveston Bay and just how important that is to the recreational fishing industry as a whole on the Texas coast. Just a reminder, back in July, the Department of Health Services issued a fish consumption ban applying to all species of catfish and spotted sea trout, and recommending limits of consumption of up to 8 ounces a person a month. Affecting all obviously that's something that got a lot of people's attention and a decision that we're watching very, very closely. And it had to do with elevated concentrations of PCBs and dioxin that are being found in those species of fish. So a source of some concern. I expect that we will continue to support the efforts by the Department of Health Services to test other fish and other bay systems to see if there are other problems out there that we may not yet be aware of. But Rebecca Hensley played a big role in that. Lance Robinson, some of our coastal fisheries team, really did a great job in that effort. Obviously, as we're kicking off dove season, thinking about our efforts to get youth hunters out and about, had a very successful year last year, great partnership with the Texas Wildlife Association. I think we had about 150 youth hunts around the state. Most of them were for deer and exotic animals and feral hogs. We expect that to go forward and do great things. I think we've touched about 10,000 youth hunters since the program's inception, and obviously we want to continue to do more. On the landowner extension front and all of our work with private landowners that our wildlife biologists do such a great job on, one of the things that we have seen is just a continued heightened interest by landowners in taking advantage of the wildlife use valuation for property tax purposes. That is a type of allowable ag use on properties. We had seen some confusion over the rules. There's a little ambiguity. There's some problems with interpretation. And so in working with the comptroller's office, we assembled a team of stakeholders representing landowners, agricultural interests, appraisal district interests, attorneys and others, both from the Department of Agriculture and others, to help kind of advise on some possible rule clarifications that might need to be made. That process is led from our end by Todd George, one of our attorneys, and we've got a notice going out for the Texas Register this week on some clarification on those rules, and I think that's going to be of interest to a lot of landowners around the state as well as appraisal districts. Last but not least, I just want to thank our law enforcement team in particular. You know, we were very concerned about Hurricane Dolly coming into the lower coast. We sent, I think, about 70 to 75 game wardens down to South Texas to assist with that, along with communication operators and maintenance staff, a lot of boats there to help, primarily with search and water, search and rescue efforts on the water, and they did a great job in that regard and just represented the state very, very ably. Also, our park team did a masterful job just of making sure that all of our parks in the Rio Grande Valley were evacuated in a very timely fashion, and then other parks that we had more inland throughout South Texas could serve as spots where refugees from the valley could go to stay while the storm blew over. So, great efforts by our law enforcement and parks team during that event. So, that's all I have to report. So, thank you, Chairman.
Thank you, Carter. I would like to take this opportunity to state that I feel the time is now for the commission to formulate some sort of action plan or a strategy on the effects of wind towers on wildlife. And with the rapid growth of the industry in both the coastal areas of South Texas and especially the Texas Panhandle, we're going to have to come up with some sort of answers for the landowners who are contacting us asking for our opinions on these and their impact on the wildlife species. As we noted in the meeting in Amarillo, avian populations and ground wildlife populations are affected both by the sighting of the towers and by the actual blade movements. And there was some excellent video of bats flying around existing the turbine nacelle and the blade, and the bats become very curious about these moving objects, and the results are sometimes less favorable than others, but I think that that's a good indication that we are bound to formulate some kind of opinion. And so perhaps by the November meeting, if we could address that on the agenda.
Absolutely, Chairman. Why don't we come back with a report on all that we're doing in that capacity and provide some more recommendations to the commission if that works for you.
Correct. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. The item number two, the acceptance of a land donation in Bexar County, Mr. Ted Hollingsworth.
Chairman, Commissioners, good morning. My name is Ted Hollingsworth. I'm with the Land Conservation Program. This item pertains to an offer of 2.5 acres of land that is contiguous with Government Canyon State Natural Area. We've actually in the past bought land from this landowner. The park manager there has done a very good job of keeping a good working relationship with the landowner. The landowner, there's a piece of property tucked in a corner of what we already own, 2.5 acres. It is over the Edwards recharge zone, and he has approached us about donating that. Our conditions to him were that he should have it surveyed at his cost, and he should fence that property consistent with the fencing around the state natural area. He has agreed and has provided a gift deed, and this would be the first reading. If you're in agreement, we'll conduct a public hearing, solicit public comment on that, and then come back in the future with a recommendation regarding acceptance of that 2.5 acres. We'd be happy to answer. Oh, you have pictures, don't we? For Montgomery Canyon, for those of you that are not familiar with it, is just the northwest of downtown San Antonio. Will soon be an urban park, about 9,000 acres. And again, that subject property is very much contiguous with and near the park entrance. The habitat is very good condition. It is habitat for the golden cheek warbler. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have about that track.
Any questions or comments by the commission? Hearing none, I'll ask staff to begin the public notice and input process. Thank you, Ted. Committee item number 3, the acceptance of a land donation in Orange County. Also, Mr. Ted Hollingsworth.
Chairman, Commissioners, my name is Ted Hollingsworth. I'm with the Land Conservation Program. This item revolves around a pipeline which is to be bored under the Tony Hausman Wildlife Management Area. You authorized staff to negotiate terms and conditions for the issuance of this easement in a previous meeting. In discussing those terms and conditions, the idea of exchanging land for the easement came up and was vetted and met favorably. Staff feels like exchanging land for the pipeline really does more to compensate for impacts caused by vegetation control and installation and management of the pipeline than perhaps cash would. The Conservation Fund got involved helping Denbury Pipeline identify mitigation opportunities, and they, at our request, contacted local landowners, identified an 89-acre tract, a very high-quality habitat contiguous with the wildlife management area. Staff feels like it would very much contribute to the mission of the wildlife management area. We have willing sellers at appraised value. The appraisal should be in this week. Denbury continues to insist that they will buy that tract. We have agreed to prorate our normal easement fees out over 15 or 20 years, whatever would be appropriate, in exchange for the subject at a donation of the subject tract. As you can see in the picture, there are large trees, some wetlands on the tract, very much consistent with the purpose for the Tony Hausman Wildlife Management Area. We're not offering any mitigation credit on that tract. It would be a straight-up addition with no regulatory implications other than compensation for the fees for the pipeline easement. It also does give us access to a paved road in a portion of the wildlife management area where we don't currently have good access. This is a first reading. With your concurrence, we will continue to pursue that, and assuming we can make that a part of the surface use agreement for the pipeline issuance, we will return to you with permission to close on that transaction. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have. Yes, sir.
There's any consideration given, I'm not saying this isn't a good deal, but any consideration given to the tract, I guess it'd be to the south, on the map, see where it says that it has a big bend in the river?
Yes, sir. Actually, we approached that landowner and the landowner on the north east corner with frontage on the river first, and we had no willing sellers. The staff prioritized the tracts that would be of most value to the wildlife management area. And this was the highest priority track where we had a willing seller.
Thank you.
Any other questions by the commission?
Just my ignorance. Why is it not mitigation? Is mitigation only when there is, it's the law requires it to happen? Or?
Well, mitigation is a term that gets used a number of different ways. We try to use mitigation when it's a regulatory requirement. We try to use the term compensation when it's a mitigation is normally required for impacts to wetlands or endangered species, and there are legal dictates for how that takes place. Compensation is something that, as an agency, we have authority to negotiate with the pipeline installer and operator.
Any other questions or comments? If there are none, I will ask Ted to begin the public notice and the process. Thank you, Ted. You're up again on committee item number 4, land acquisition in Yoakum County.
Good morning, Chairman, Commissioners. My name is Ted Hollingsworth. I'm still with the Land Conservation Program. This particular item pertains to the Fitzgerald Ranch. Some of you may not have heard of the Fitzgerald Ranch. We have been looking for an opportunity to benefit the lesser prairie chicken for a number of years. We are working cooperatively with the Nature Conservancy on the Fitzgerald Ranch on acquisition of property. The ranch itself has been acquired by a grant of Pittman Robertson dollars to the Nature Conservancy. It straddles Terry and Yoakum County. Nature Conservancy is working with adjacent landowners to try and enlarge that. It's currently about 6,000 acres. But there's an adjacent track that's fairly critical for making the whole track contiguous and manageable. The track belongs to the General Land Office. The General Land Office had put it on their list to sell to the public at public auction. At our request, it was taken off of that list, but in that process, GLO can only sell the property to another state agency. So we're proposing to buy that. It would be managed in the interim by the Nature Conservancy as part of the Fitzgerald Ranch Lesser Prairie Chicken Preserve. It's 241 acres. The appraised value is 53,000 acres for the tract. We would buy that with land sale proceeds, Fund 9 land sale proceeds. It is the intent of the Nature Conservancy that once they've completed the acquisition and putting together of this Lesser Prairie Chicken Preserve, that it will come to Texas Parks and Wildlife and be managed as a wildlife management area, primarily for the recovery and benefit of the lesser prairie chicken. Again, this was the first reading of what would be a two-meeting process. We're at this point requesting permission to enter into a contract with the General Land Office, dependent upon your authorization to close, and then to solicit public notice and public input on this acquisition. Be happy to answer any questions.
That creates some. Can you go back to that, please? Creates a couple of inholdings for us there, doesn't it?
Yes, sir, it does. And
associated with that, or?
I know that the Nature Conservancy is already in communication with those landowners. They felt if we allowed this tract, this 241-acre tract, to be auctioned into the private sector, that we would probably lose the opportunity to make that Fitzgerald Ranch a large continuous property. I think they are optimistic that both of those landowners are willing to work with them on either an exchange or a sale to make that tract whole. But without this piece, we really didn't have another opportunity to join those properties. This is also pretty high-quality habitat, and just off the record, there was some concern that if it sold into the public sector, chicken hunting and mule deer hunting would take place on that tract, to the detriment of what we're trying to accomplish on those adjacent properties.
But access issues to those inholdings that are manageable and
yes, sir.
Time.
Okay. Yes, sir. And again, the Nature Conservancy it does have a dialogue going with those landowners. The access issues we can't legally landlock a piece of land by our acquisition of intervening property.
Thanks.
Just in clarification, the 241 acres that's currently owned by the GLO, will that be purchased by, and you may have said this, but be purchased by the Nature Conservancy and then by TPW or directly by TPW?
It will have to be purchased by TPW because when the General Land Office has already identified it and put it on the sale roster to be sold, they can only take it off for the purpose of selling to a state agency.
Right, sir. Okay. All right. I would also like to say, having personally visited this area, that in all my life in the Panhandle, I've seen more lesser prairie chickens on this tract of land than I've seen anywhere else in the area.
Really?
And it's the day we Carter was there as well. The day we visited, I would have bet that someone had planted these birds. But everyone guaranteed me that they were native.
They were native.
Yeah. So, any other comments from the commission?
I want to follow up on Dan's comment. I don't understand how they'd be landlocked. Isn't there a public road that goes through here?
These are not public roads. These are ranch roads. But by law, our acquisition of a property that straddles a road that provides access, we cannot legally landlock an adjacent landowner. So they will continue to have whatever access they currently have.
And the amount of access to this property is rather minimal, so I don't think it's going to really be an issue. But the landscape is rather, it doesn't look that way from the aerial photograph, but it's pretty rugged. The vegetation's a lot thicker than you would imagine.
This is pretty typical. It's a lot of grass. There are some brushy areas. It's not exactly hilly, but it's not flat. And the biologists tell me it's exceptional habitat for the birds. And this is an area where we've been, again, for several years, have been trying to identify an opportunity to create a lesser prairie chicken preserve.
As that slide also suggests, there's other species besides lesser prairie chickens that inhabit the area. Hearing no other comments, I will ask staff to begin public notice and input process. Ted, you may as well just stay there because you're going to be there for a while.
Yeah,
I mind if I pull up a chair?
Right. Committee item number 5, land exchange and conservation easement in Bandera and Medina counties.
Good morning, Chairman and Commissioners. My name is Ted Hollingsworth. I'm with the Land Conservation Program. This is an item that you have actually seen once before. This is the Hill Country State Natural Area. We have an adjacent ranch to that property, and shown, actually the entire ranch is not shown in this slide, but it's on the south side of the Hill Country State Natural Area. The owners of that ranch, because of the poor access into that ranch, have approached us several times over the last 20 years about granting access across the state natural area into that ranch. The owner of the ranch died recently, and the heirs are very motivated to divide that ranch and to secure access into it. So we've been working with them for about the last year and have come up with an arrangement to provide access that we think results in a net benefit to the state natural area. And in a nutshell, we would trade them that sliver of land in yellow, which will give them an opportunity to construct a road into the ranch, which is outlined in white. We would get the property in green, which is about twice the size of that we would lose. It also is a pretty spectacular hilltop, large cave on that property, very high potential for recreation. Some nice views from that track. And then the remainder of the owner's ranch, about 700 acres, would go under a conservation easement that would limit him to construction of only a couple of residences, which would ultimately limit the traffic on that road. The reason this isn't going to result in much of a net impact is because the road you can see, and I don't know if we have the road that is visible running through the ranch actually provides unlimited access into these ranches here already by easement that was deeded long before we got the property. So the, the change in traffic pattern should not affect park operations, but the conservation easement and the gain of that mountain and the cave and that habitat will contribute to the state natural area. We staff have been working very closely on this for a number of months. We feel like this is in the benefit of the state natural area to proceed with this. And if you concur, this will be the second reading, and this motion will appear before you tomorrow. Be happy to answer any questions you might have about the proposed transaction.
Any additional questions or comments from the commission? Hearing none, I'll place this item on the Thursday commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Item number six, surprisingly by Ted Hollingsworth.
Chairman, Commission, for the record, my name is Ted Hollingsworth. I'm with the Land Conservation Program. This is the second reading of this item. You have seen it previously. Big Bend Ranch, for those of you that are not very familiar with it, it is in the Big Bend country of West Texas. It is almost adjacent to the national park. We're actually working on some land arrangements that would give our visitors direct access to the national park and vice versa. We also have well over 100,000 acres at Black Cat Wildlife Management Area in the Big Bend region of West Texas. This particular landowner owned Big Bend Ranch at one time, and when it was acquired by us, there were several tracts with questionable title. We have since done a lot of title work on those. The owner has done some title work. We've determined that the owner has about five inholdings, which he's willing to trade to us in order to exchange to consolidate two of his inholdings. He would end up with a single piece of property. We would end up with the five inholdings. The five inholdings we would gain total about a little over 1,400 acres. He would receive about 500 acres. We've had a very thorough appraisal done of those tracts. This is a straight-up trade at appraised value. The value in those inholdings is that a couple of them do straddle trails that are important for us implementing our public use plan. The consolidated inholding does not interfere in any way with our public use plan. Staff does recommend that you allow us to put an agenda item on tomorrow's agenda to proceed to close that transaction. We do have a contract with the landowner, again, all based on appraised value. This has been thoroughly vetted in public session and with the staff at the park and in State Parks Division to make sure that the consolidated tract is not going to interfere with park operations or implementation of the public use plan in any way. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Ted, excuse me, go ahead, Rob. Could you go back to the slide, the aerial photograph? Do we own the minerals under this Big Bend Ranch or the Black Gap Wildlife Management Area?
Well, our ownership has come to us through numerous transactions at both of those. And so our mineral ownership varies. At Black Gap, for example, the tracts that we've received from the General Land Office, the Land Office has retained those minerals. Those tracts we've acquired from private owners. We acquire all the minerals owned by those private owners. And at Black Gap, in most cases, it is all the minerals. What percentage we own on both sites would require a lot of research, and quite frankly, I can't tell you, but it varies. We do own all of the minerals in much of Big Bend Ranch State Park, and I know that because we were approached recently about somebody wanting to do some clay mining, and we were able to just simply deny the request because we did own the minerals.
Well, as you're well aware, there's a major oil and gas play in the Fort Stockton area, and I'm just curious if it did move in that direction, what our ownership would be. But we obviously want to look into that when the event presents itself. Commissioner Doug.
Well, that was one of my questions. The other is, when you say that this is based on appraisals, who does the department use as its appraiser?
We have a list of approved appraisers, but quite frankly, we only use about half a dozen of them because in most cases, where especially if there's any prospect of using state or federal funding, we require a what's called a Yellow Book appraisal or appraisal that complies with federal standards, which is a much more detailed appraisal. And what we found is that there are a lot of appraisals who do very good appraisal work, but don't do appraisals to federal standards. So there are several that we use regularly. In the case of this transaction, we used a fellow here in Austin by the name of Jim Jeffries, and we used him because he has done appraisals in the Big Bend region for us in the past. They've been very excellent, very defensible appraisals. We've never had any conflicts with landowners over those appraisals. We've never had any conflicts with NPS or U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service over using those to justify grant awards of federal money. So in this case, we used someone that we knew would do a good job the first time.
Any other comments or questions from the commission? Hearing none, I'll place this item on the Thursday commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Committee item number 7, conveyance of pipeline easement in Tarrant County. Once again, Ted.
Isn't it lunchtime yet? Chairman, Commissioners, good morning. My name is Ted Hollingsworth. I'm with the Land Conservation Program. This item pertains to a request for the granting of a pipeline easement for a gathering line across the Fort Worth Fish Hatchery, which, as you can see, is on the outskirts of Fort Worth. This is the property. The staff have routed the easement along a fence line to minimize its impact to habitat. Staff feels like the alternative that the gas company had was to run across adjacent property, which would have been a greater impact to the environment. We've gone through our standard terms and conditions process. What we've negotiated with the pipeline operator is that in exchange for their easement, they are going to revamp one of the fishing ponds, one of the old fishing ponds. They're going to clean it out and line it. It's going to be turned into a kid fish pond. Staff at the fish hatchery then will be able to conduct kid fish programs, which requires a pond that's dependable for holding water and is deep enough to stock with fish, and of course has clear banks so you can get kids down to the edge to fish. Staff have been wanting to do this. They think this is a very good use of this opportunity as compensation for this small gathering line across the site. This is an action item, and if you're in agreement, this is the item that will appear on tomorrow's agenda.
Commissioner Duggan.
What is the width of the temporary construction easement that XTO wants to for this one?
Well, the total easement is 20 foot, and
it's permanent. What's the temporary? Is there a temporary?
There's no additional. No, sir. Will not be any additional. It's a 4-inch gathering line. It does not require a lot of staging of equipment.
Is the easement limit XTO to one line?
Yes, sir. It sure does.
Thank you.
Any other comments? Questions from the commission? Hearing none, I'll place this item on the Thursday commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Committee items number 8 and 9 will be heard in executive session, so we will move now to committee item number 10. And batting a perfect score is once again Ted Hollingsworth.
This is an interesting item. Chairman, Commissioners, my name is Ted Hollingsworth with the Land Conservation Program. We were approached probably 3 years ago by the Green Burial Council, which is a group of conservation-minded folks who are looking at the recent interest in environmentally friendly alternatives to traditional burial, and are trying to work with state agencies and private nonprofit trusts to try and turn this interest into conservation, land conservation. And that we've been working together for about 3 years to look at whether there's an opportunity in Texas to tap into this interest. And so what we've done is we've negotiated an agreement for your consideration that would allow death care providers in Texas to offer the option of scattering ashes on selected state park properties. Currently, under state law, we cannot prevent the scattering of ashes on undeveloped state park land. And currently it occurs, we don't know how often, but oftentimes families will, out of courtesy, will notify us that they are scattering ashes. What the Green Burial Council would like to do is work directly with death care providers so that those that are willing to participate would offer an option to those families to scatter those ashes and to take the fee associated with that and to put half of that money into a dedicated account at the Texas Parks and Wildlife Foundation to be used only for acquisition of new state park lands. This would be a three-year pilot program, this agreement that we negotiated. A small area in two or three parks would be designated. We would put a deed restriction on that so that if, you know, we scattered Dad's ashes out there, we would know that it wouldn't have a parking lot on it or a building on it a few years from now. This is a market that's really untested. I've talked to several other states now. There are a couple of private trusts that have very successfully done this. There's a very large conservation tract that's being paid for in New Mexico right now through a combination of ash scattering and green burials. There's a successful program in North Carolina. There's one in California and another one in Michigan. We would be the first state agency to enter into a partnership to explore this market. Staff have been very careful to craft an agreement that would not constrain our operations or overly bind us in the future. It is a three-year agreement. Our agency's name would not be associated with this program without written permission from the agency. This would be between Green Burial Partners and the death care industry, and it would be a conservation option that would be offered, again, with the money going to the foundation, and hopefully at some point enough funding would accrue that we could use those funds to help us acquire a priority site adjacent to one of our existing state parks, or perhaps even help us acquire a new state park in the future. We do have an agreement that our legal department has reviewed, that our state parks people have reviewed. We've been very careful about crafting this agreement. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have. We thought, considering this is a little different, we thought we would very much like to have your feedback before we proceed.
Well, I have a comment. I mean, how do you have a three-year pilot program? I mean, once you designate an area and people scatter ashes on it, you can't.
That's correct.
You could not change that piece of property back to.
Yes, sir. That's correct. We're looking at a 2 or 3 acre area at Brazos Bend and another 2 or 3 acre area at McKinney Falls State Park. We've worked with the staff there. These are areas, in one case a restored prairie, in another case a restored forest parkland setting. This staff cannot envision ever wanting to put buildings or parking lots on. I mean, this would be protection that staff would like to see on these sites anyway. It would not preclude a picnic table or a trail, but it would preclude hard cover on these areas. Again, I work closely with Walt Dabney and with Legal. We feel that the risk is minimal. And potentially, if this is something that the public latches onto and there's a growing interest in, could result in a large net benefit to the agency over time. And we won't really know unless we test it.
It's nonprofit Green Burial Council. Who are they? I mean, who is that?
There are some interested private individuals who formed this 501c3 nonprofit organization and have literally been going to several state fish and wildlife agencies and to several of the trusts like Trust for Public Lands, TNC. I mean, they've approached several groups trying to explore ways to turn this growing interest into their interest in conservation. They want to see more land conserved for the future, and they see this growing interest. I saw a show on television just a couple nights ago about the growing interest in being buried in pine boxes and canvas bags and things other than fiberglass boxes and full of formaldehyde. So there's a growing, there have been articles in AARP, there's been an article in Time magazine about the growing interest nationwide in not taking up so much space with plastic boxes in this country. And so they're looking for ways to tap into this interest and try to turn it into conservation. Commissioner Friedman.
Have they developed a demand model so we have a sense of how much revenue this might put into a fund over time?
They have talked to economists about developing models, and if you have no baseline data at all, it really isn't possible to project what the interest is. The project in New Mexico has been very successful. There's one in California that's been very successful, and one in North Carolina. But they all include the option of green burial. What they've done is they've taken a large piece of land, they've designated an area for, literally for pine caskets and canvas burial shrouds, a small area, but they've collected enough money from people who don't want to be in plastic boxes to literally pay for, in some cases, hundreds or even thousands of acres of land. I will say that we have talked to some of the trusts in Texas, if this program were very successful, about a trust picking up an important piece of property, designating a small area for green burial, and then taking that land that is not in green burial and adding it to a park or a wildlife management area. Be neat if that would happen someday. This is a way to just test the market and see if there's any interest in Texas in that.
So is this land covered by a conservation easement?
No, sir. The problem with conservation easements on state park lands is you've got to have a third party hold them. It doesn't make sense to have Ducks Unlimited hold a conservation easement on Brazos Glen State Park.
Right.
So we've agreed that a deed restriction, and we're the state. Hopefully we can be trusted, you know, to observe a deed restriction on one of our properties.
One would hope.
Yeah. One would hope.
Yeah. The only thing I'd ask is that green burial counts would be vetted somehow. I just want to make sure they're a legitimate group, that's all.
Yes, sir.
Ideas fine.
Chairman.
Yes, Commissioner Parker.
Ed, what are your known and or perceived downsides of this?
The worst case scenario is
a known one. Are you starting with known first?
The known is that people can do this already and we have no control over it. The worst case scenario is that one person buys into the program and that we have $750 to spend on land acquisition, and we have a couple of acres at Brazos Bend State Park and a couple of acres at McKinney Falls State Park that are under this deed restriction. That's worst case scenario. I've worked carefully with Walt and with legal and with some of the field staff to make sure that even in a worst case scenario, we don't end up stuck with something that's going to mess with our public use of these sites in the future or our ability to manage or develop these property, our state parks in the future. Alternatively, if we have several hundred or several thousand people participate, we could be talking into money that would translate into significant acreage to be added to our state park system. There are now guidelines for ashes that can be called green ashes. There are standards, particulate size and composition. And I don't think you can put enough ashes on 2 acres of Brazos Bend for the nutrient load or the introduction of nutrients or materials to have a negative impact. And we've talked to TNRC, we've talked to TCEQ, we've talked to the General Land Office, we've talked to our biologists, we've talked to chemists. You can't scatter enough ashes to have a deleterious impact on the habitat. We don't believe that's possible.
Any other comments?
I really expected a livelier discussion. Quite frankly.
I just want to say, I think, you know.
No pun intended. Yeah, right.
If you all get all of this better, you know, I just think it's ingenious. I mean, whoever came up with this idea, I mean, it makes perfect sense if it works. I mean, how much better can it be? Mm-hmm.
At the risk of another pun, we're trying not to leave any stones unturned when it comes to finding resources for adding to our state park system.
Okay, Ted, I think you have been up for a while.
And if I've worn out my welcome, I'll extend it.
Did you save that one for last?
Thank you for that presentation.
And this is not an action item. We're simply advising you that if you don't instruct otherwise, we would like to proceed with this agreement.
Thank you. As I mentioned earlier, Conservation Committee items 8 and 9 will be discussed in executive session, and therefore I will announce a recess to executive session. I would like to announce that pursuant to the requirements of Chapter 551 Government Code, referred to as the Open Meetings Act, an executive session will be held at this time for the purpose of deliberation of real estate matters under Section 551.072 of the Texas Open Meetings Act, and seeking legal advice from the General Counsel under Section 551.071 of the Open Meetings Act. We are now recessed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
What's new about that?
Open mic. I think he does it on purpose.
How did you know that?
Well, I can tell by the expression on her face. Each time you come in the room.
Life in my house.
I won't say anything. I won't pick on you.
Robert French made a comment about that last night.
That wasn't that it?
If we could take our seats, please, we'd like to go ahead and reconvene.
Back to the seminars. It's all right here. Whatever you want to do. You don't want to do it. Okay, what I mean, seriously. Oh, yeah. Just taking everybody needed to eat, so.
Okay. I would like to now reconvene the regular session of the Conservation Committee. If everyone could please take their seat.
You owe
me. I'm that gavel. Back your gavel.
You need
for what time?
I'm used to this. Come in. Outstanding. Thank you very much.
There you go.
Thank you all very much. The next item on our agenda in the Conservation Committee is item number 8, conveyance of easement in Aransas County. Once again, we have Ted Hollingsworth.
Ted, you're kind of hogging the show here, buddy.
Good afternoon, Chairman and Commissioners. My name is Ted Hollingsworth. I'm with the Land Conservation Program. This is the second item of a reading regarding a request from the Lamar Improvement District for an easement across Goose Island State Park to bring utilities into a new subdivision that's being constructed on the east side of the park called the Broadway, which you can see on this map. Staff has been working with both the owners of the Broadway project and with the Lamar Improvement District on a set of compensatory actions that would help offset impacts to habitat on the Lamar Peninsula. These include shutting down South Street to all traffic except emergency traffic. It includes a buffer around an existing tidal wetland. It includes a setback, a building setback and buffer that would be in the form of a conservation easement for a strip of land adjacent to the state park. It includes routing the utility lines in such a way as to minimize impact to vegetation in the neighborhood. It includes a donation of cash to Goose Island State Park to help with erosion control projects in the park. The staff has worked very closely with both Lamar Improvement District and the developers of the Broadway project to come up with a package that we feel like really does reflect our interest in protecting the habitat on the peninsula and is fair to all parties concerned. And would like the commission to consider placing this item on the agenda for tomorrow.
Thank you, Ted. Any further discussion or questions for Ted on this issue? Hearing none, I'll place this item on the Thursday commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Committee item number 9, land sale in Harris County. Once again, we have Ted Hollingsworth.
Chairman, Commissioners, good afternoon. My name is Ted Hollingsworth. I'm with the Land Conservation Program.
This is an item you've also seen before. Texas Parks and Wildlife has been working with the city of LaPorte in Harris County. We have a property there that we've had for 46 years now. It's been a regional office for state parks for most of that time. But it's right in the middle of an area that the city of LaPorte would like to acquire for a redevelopment revitalization project. It's on the original town circle, and the city would like to acquire that property and implement this revitalization project, which is going to require removing that building and doing some street work and some landscape work and putting a new building in that location. This is an aerial view. The building is a flat roof building. Again, it's 48 years old now. It's been a high cost maintenance building, very difficult building to keep up with. The department had $300,000 scheduled to renovate the building, which is more than the appraised value of the building. The city has offered the department substantially more than the appraised value of the building. We've had it appraised recently. The city will also give State Parks Division enough time to construct a new facility at Sheldon Lake State Park and relocate all of the functions to Sheldon Lake State Park before they require us vacating the premises. With your concurrence, we will place this item on the agenda for tomorrow's meeting for consideration for action. Be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Any further questions from the commission? Hearing none, I'll place this item on the Thursday commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Ted, I know we would all like to thank you for your excellent work on this rather lengthy agenda, and you didn't get a break on any of the items, but thank you again.
Does that mean I can go get lunch now?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, this committee has completed its business, and I will turn the meeting back over to you.